We had planned, as I had told you about on Monday evening, we planned on having a Prism West Virginia American History chat session last night. And everything was go. We got over there to the Irma Bird Center. And we got everything set up. Got the whole rig cooking. Everything checked out. We were all ready to go. Except for one thing. No internet. None. Zero. Zilch. Zip. Nada. Niente. Nihil. None. Did I mention none? Yeah, no internet. So it was more than a little bit frustrating, both for Dr. Bill, for Keith Lilly, Professor Keith Lilly, and for, you know, me. It was the damnedest thing. Frontier Communications, who took over for Verizon when Verizon took the money and ran out of West Virginia. Lovely story, that. A couple of years ago, we got a $20 million grant here in West Virginia from the federal government for increasing the accessibility to the interweb tubes. You know, it's a series of tubes. It's not a big truck. I sent that to somebody in an internet just the other day. No, we got $20 million to expand access to the interweb tubes for rural West Virginians. And our governor, the ever-so-likable Joe Manchin, who is now the ever-so-likable Senator Joe Manchin, thought that the best thing he could possibly do would be to give a, just give $20 million worth of big love to Verizon. Which he did. Don't hold me to the number, but it was big, and it was measured in millions. But he gave it all to Verizon. Didn't share the love. Didn't share the love with any of the other internet providers in the state who might have, you know, used it to actually expand access to places that don't have it. But no. All the money went to Verizon. All the empty bajillion dollars went to Verizon. Verizon, being a 1% corporation in this country, promptly said, "Well, dang, looky here. Looky here what done showed up. We got us $20 million, Uncle Jed." And then they promptly said, "You know what? We're not making enough money doing business in West Virginia, so what we want to do is we want to sell off our West Virginia operations. Goodbye now! Been fun. You got the $20 million? Yeah. Check clear? Yeah. We're out of here." And split. Leaving the state of West Virginia to the tender mercies of an outfit called Frontier. And I think they're called Frontier because that's their service delivery style. They're operating on technologies.
Marshall Plan went, we rebuilt everything that was destroyed. And now some of our best trading partners, some of the people that we have best relationships with, the Germans and the Japanese. And the Italians, to a degree. That generation did that. And they brought that home. And they built the largest, most prosperous nation in the world. They built a middle class, second to none in the history of civilization. They built an economy where someone with an eighth grade education, like my grandfather, could work hard, make a solid wage, put his kids through school, buy a nice house in a decent neighborhood, and retire with some security, retire with some dignity. They built that. And I go back to that generation and I go, man, what's wrong with us? And you look at the numbers. I mean, you look at the reality of what's going on in this country. The smarter we seem to get, the dumber we seem to be getting. I go back to the 1940s, and the people over at the Too Much Online blog have done a really nice graph that just lays this out in very, very stark terms. You know, 1940, we were getting about 54.7% of the national income, working people, people like you and me. We were taking about 54.7%. College attainment was about 4.6%. You had less than 5% of the people in this country who were college graduates. And what's amazing about this graph is every decade, it got better. College graduates increased. It went from, you know, the 40s from under 5 to the 50s when it was over 6 to the mid to the 60s when it was almost 8 to the 70s when it was up to 11 to the 80s when it was 17 to the 90s when it hit 21 into the 2000s where it's over a quarter. And the smarter we get, the more education we get, it seems the dumber we are. Because remember what they told us during the 90s? We're a knowledge society now. We need to, you know, we need to work smarter with our brains, and that's where all the good income is going to come from. Well, I go back to the middle of my grandfather's working years. You know, the 1960s, 1970s, when he was raising his family, he was working hard. He was raising his family, taking care of that. Back then, the pinnacle of what you and I, the working people, of what his generation of working people, what they got. The pinnacle of how much the pie was divided in their favor. In fact, the height of it all, late 1960s, early 1970s, almost two-thirds. We were getting almost two-thirds of the pie in the working class. Think about that for a second. Out of all the money that's being spent, people who worked for a living got two-thirds of it. So you go back and think, well, how did we have this large middle class? How did we have all these people buying nice homes and driving cars and taking vacations and doing all of these things that were the hallmark of the 50s, 60s, and the 70s, the golden years of our economy? How did that happen? How did that generation create broad prosperity? Well, they did it because they formed labor unions, because they understood collective action, they understood coming together, and they understood fighting. They destroyed fascism. They destroyed the corporatocracy, the melding of corporations and government, which is what the Germans were doing and the Italians. I mean, think of what they said about fascism. Yeah, you know, the trains run on time. Because you've got the power of the military and the power of government being used by corporations and vice versa. And they came home and said, you know what? We don't want it that way. We fought that over there. Why do we want to bring that back here? We want to have jobs for people. We want full employment policies. And we want unemployment when people get hurt. Or unemployment when people lose their jobs. And we want workers' compensation when people get hurt. And we want it to be generous enough that if it happens, we can live. And I look at, you know, the older we get and the more college educated we get, it seems the dumber we get. Because right now, our share of the national income that goes to wages is at the lowest point it's been since 1940. We are taking in less money than we did as a working class than they did in the 1940s. And I go back to the thing I talked about the other day. Nick Hanar. He's one of the guys who co-founded, one of the original investors in Amazon. He's a venture capitalist. He's one of these guys who said, I want to make money. And he says, the way I'm going to make money is that you have people in the middle class who have money. And he said, look, if we just went back to the numbers of 1980, the way it was in 1980, if we just went back and said, we're going to distribute the pie like it was in 1980, which was 60, we were getting 65%, not even the pinnacle. Not even the highest point, somewhere around 65%. Each middle class family in this country, if you're making 55 grand right now, you'd be making $13,000 more. If the pie was just divvied up the way it was back then. And this is a guy who, he makes his living creating businesses, creating jobs, and he's saying, look, we need to be paying workers better so that they have disposable income, so that they can go to stores and buy my product, so that they can buy the little Kindle-y thingy, and they can buy all the other gadgets that are out there, because only people with disposable income can do that. And how did it happen that we built this middle class? And that's why today I think it's important to look back. Yes, as a nation, we came together after Pearl Harbor, just as we did after 9/11. But I think there's a whole different lesson to be learned from each, and especially the way each leader led. Back during the Bush years, what did they ask? After 9/11, what was the highest calling? Go shopping. Is that what he said? I remember. Hey, boy, let's go shopping. Get the economy moving again. Nothing from business. After the collapse, what happened? After the September of 2008 collapse, what happened? Are we asking businesses to be patriotic? You know, my grandfather told me about before the war, there were war bonds and the people were coming together and businesses were hiring people to make sure that, you know, things got done so we could have this war effort. But I guess that's the difference between back then. They knew they were all in it together. Back then they knew they were going to all sink or swim as a nation, not right or left, but as an entire nation. And after September 11th, well, I guess maybe when that initial wave of patriotism died down, maybe it was, hey, what can I get out of it? And maybe we should have read Smedley Butler's piece, War is a Racket. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. If you've got something in your mind, question, comment, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union says it's not supporting a planned December 12th shutdown of West Coast ports organized by the Occupy movement. The union sent a memo to its members and leaders that said in part, quote, to be clear, the ILWU, the Coast Longshore Division, and Local 21 are not coordinating independently or in conjunction with any self-proclaimed organization or group to shut down any port or terminal, particularly as it relates to our dispute with EGT in Longview, end quote. ILWU International President Robert McElrath says that the ILWU, quote, shares the Occupy Wall Street movement's concerns about corporate abuses and the future of the middle class, but we must be clear that any actions organized by outside groups, including the proposed December 12th shutdown of various terminals on the West Coast, have not been vetted by our union's democratically led process, end quote. ILWU Local 10 President Richard Mead says its members should take guidance from this memo. He says Local 10 members have the right to speak freely and to assemble, but should make it clear that they aren't speaking officially for the ILWU when they do so. The Occupy movement says the ILWU is prevented by contracts from authorizing a port shutdown, but Occupy says if enough protesters converge on the ports, an arbitrator will decide on the spot if it's safe for ILWU members to work. If it isn't, the workers will be sent home with pay. Thousands of protesters are in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back the Capitol action. Carl Morrow is a Wisconsin SEIU member, one of many activists who have been trying to meet with U.S. Representative Paul Ryan. They sat in at Ryan's office.
There's lots of people that are out here now. We have about, I would say, maybe 50 to 75 people, and we're going to sit here as long as it takes until, you know, he shows up, and we'll be here all week doing the same thing until somebody talks to us. We've been in Kenosha, where his office is. We've done rallies there. We've put in dozens of calls to his office, and still no response.
Edward Jude is also with SEIU in Milwaukee.
We're trying to let our political leaders know the importance of them bringing jobs back into the community and trying to let them know our needs.
The current owner of the Upper Big Branch mine will pay $200 million to settle civil and criminal penalties in that mining disaster that killed 29 miners in April of 2010. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the payment from Alpha Natural Resources is a welcome beginning, But Trumka says it's far from the end of the justice that the miners and their families deserve. Trumka says the disaster was caused by corporate greed winning out over safety precautions. Trumka is calling for stiff jail sentences for those responsible for the disaster. This newscast made possible in part by the United Mine Workers of America and by the United Steel Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Boy, that isn't the truth. You look around the country, Alabama in particular, you know, Georgia, want to use prison labor. Demand their firehouses. Alabama, they want to use prison labor to pick the crops in the field. Amazing stuff. And you look right here at home, here in Pennsylvania, according to reports from the Department of State Campaign Financing, their website, the Student First Pack has contributed almost $5.3 million to the members of the Senate Education Committee. And why? Why? Oh, yeah. Vouchers! Gotta have vouchers! Almost $5.3 million of the people on that committee. I've asked the question a thousand times, and I will ask it a thousand times more. If we've got $5.3 million to influence a handful of people who sit on a committee, don't we have enough money to fix the 143 schools that are having problems? I think we should. Anyway, I've asked our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, to come on, talk to us a little bit about this and a couple other things. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here. How are you?
I'm a little frustrated. You know, I look at this almost $5.3 million that this Student's First Pack, again, that's, you got to love the euphemistic name, but $5.3 million lobbying just a handful of people on this Senate Education Committee kind of worries me.
It should do a whole lot more than worry. It should take your breath away. Because, as I learned many years ago during the Watergate hearing, follow the money. First and foremost, this euphemistic name, Students First. If they were so interested in Students First, instead of spending $5+ million on a handful of members of one Senate committee, they'd spend the $5 million that they apparently have on educating students and giving kids educational opportunity. Even when you say it fast, $5+ million is a breathtaking amount of money.
Absolutely.
Okay, this is exponentially more money than a typical working family will make in a lifetime. And they put it out in the course of a very short period of time to a handful of politicians, and you gotta ask why. Well, when you ask why, you don't have to travel too far to understand that vouchers, but more significantly, charters and educational improvement tax credits, so-called EITCs, are so lucrative for the private business people that are behind this so-called Student First phony organization that it's a small investment for them to make for the hundreds of millions of dollars they're thieving out of Pennsylvania public schools every year right now on charters alone.
Yep. And it's not even just charters, and it's not even just the EITC. It's also the testing, and it's all the supplies, and it's all the fact that we've given these testing companies, they claim proprietary patents on 2+2, so we've got to buy the tests from them just to give the kids to begin with.
Well, it's even worse than that, and you need to understand, and our listeners need to understand how much worse. Charter schools are public schools. They're financed exclusively with taxpayer money, not private money, not quasi-private money, not even foundation money, not even the money that would come from non-profit organizations. 100 cents of the dollars, of every single dollar that finances charter schools, comes from taxpayers, from you and me and all of our listeners. Yet charter schools don't have to publish budgets, don't have to abide by ethical standards, have no transparency, have no accountability, and don't even have a funding formula that is based on the education they allegedly deliver, but instead have a funding formula that's based on what the school district from which each student comes pays on average to educate students in the public school district. And then, because there are no transparency standards, ethical practice standards, accountability standards, the people who run the charter school contract with a management company, which in turn owns a building that they turn around and lease back to the charter school, sometimes charging charter schools, I've discovered, as much as 2 years' worth of advanced rent,
wow,
plus collecting the current rent. And then on top of that, they hire the same person or a member of that person's family who's running the charter school for a contracting company to manage the building.
So much for students first.
So it should be properly recognized as students last. This is the race to the bottom. And as they race to the bottom, they are dismantling public schools. And in dismantling public schools, dismantling a fundamental foundation of our democracy.
In your research of this stuff, are you finding that any of the cyber charters, the charters, the offshoots, any of the things that they're throughout the country, the vouchers, any of this stuff, are you finding anywhere where it actually works?
To the contrary, Rick, we are finding that the vast majority of charter schools, students don't perform as well as students that are enrolled in school district operated public schools. These are all public schools, of course, but some are school district operated and some are privately operated. What we find instead is that there is a dramatic fall off and in the cyber charter schools, the so-called online schools, the ones that are collecting this same huge amount of money but have no bricks and mortar to support whatsoever. The cyber charter schools of the 12 that are operating in Pennsylvania, 8 have failed to meet the AYP, the average yearly progress required of public schools.
Yeah,
and the other 4 are barely making it and not making it at all subjects.
Yeah, I was just reading the Reading Eagle had a story on Sunday where they had looked at 11, not all of the cyber charters in the state, but they had looked at 11 of them that I guess operated in Berks County, and only 2 of them hit the PSSA targets. And you look at the 18 public schools in Berks County, and they said only one of them, which is Reading, and Reading's always had a lot of problems, that didn't meet the PSSA marks. So, you know, this argument that, you know, the cyber charter schools are, you know, going to give kids in failing schools an opportunity, I'm not seeing that.
Listen, the real world is that PA cyber school, cyber charter school, is spending its money not on education, not on building or heating or electricity or water or shoveling snow or cutting grass, even around the school, because they don't have to do any of that stuff. They're spending it on advertising. Look in your mailbox.
Yep.
Look at the billboards along the Pennsylvania Turnpike or Interstate 81, financed by that charter school, that cyber charter school, encouraging people to enroll their children. Well, that's money that shouldn't be spent. This is taxpayer money. It shouldn't be spent on advertising. It should be spent on doing their mission, educating children.
Yeah, and that Reading Eagle article highlighted that. They had looked at the Brandywine Heights School District, and the superintendent said, look, we pay for each student somewhere between $4,500 and $5,000, yet they pay the tuition of the cyber charter of up to $9,000.
Yeah.
So where's the rest of that money? Where's that $4,500 going?
Well, it's going to the people who make those political contributions to members of the Senate Education Committee that you talked about at the beginning of this segment. That's the point. Look, if you're a business person and you have $10,000 to invest, if you invested in the stock market and you're really smart and really lucky, 5 years from now you'll have your $10,000 becomes $20,000. Okay? If, on the other hand, you invest $10,000 of your money in buying yourself a politician, you're going to get hundreds of millions of dollars back.
Yep.
There's a guy named Von Gregorian, and I don't normally mention names here, but Von Gregorian, who operates charter schools through a company that he owns, has himself passed out the better part of $250,000 in political contributions, many of those dollars aimed at buying up school boards in southeastern Pennsylvania. He happens to own a huge mansion on the main line in Philadelphia in Gladwin, Pennsylvania, and just completed the purchase of 2 additional lots in Palm Beach, Florida, that are the second largest purchase of real property in Palm Beach County. Okay? Oceanfront stuff. $32+ million.
See what our education dollars will buy?
You know, it's the finest stuff money can buy.
You know, and you bring his name up, and that was the name that was thrown around when we were talking about the school in Chester.
Yeah.
It was the Science and Discovery High School there that some 80 kids who, because they don't have enough certified teachers, not going to be able to graduate because they have split the school, they have split the funding, and it's just not there.
Yeah, well, and oh, by the way, same group of people who say we don't need accountability, we don't need transparency, we don't need to be bound by those mandates from the state to have ethical practices in what we do. We shouldn't be compelled to do things like publicly bid or reveal what we're paying to who.
But
by the way, don't ask us to have prevailing wages on the construction project that we undertake that are financed by taxpayer dollars, because we don't know what these buildings are going to be used for before we sign a lease. Forget about those little bitty toilets and those low little sinks in a building. That doesn't mean they're for an elementary school. That just means that we were speculating, and we shouldn't be bound up in things like separate prime contracts for electrical, mechanical, and HVAC in buildings, or that we should have to actually pay the construction workers that do this work in the buildings where we're going to entrust our most important asset, our children, in a safe fashion, you know, that they should be covered by the prevailing wage law.
Now, I was going to ask you about this House Bill 1329, and there's an action that people are that are being asked to take an action to get people to weigh in on this, and we've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Just click on Irwin Aronson's name; it'll take you right there. But this HB 1329, the way I'm getting it is, it's going to raise the threshold of the construction projects of how much they have to bid out. Anything, I guess it's like $185,000 and less they can hand to a brother-in-law or to a friend or something like that?
You got it, but let me simplify it for everybody. This is legislation to cut construction workers' wages in Pennsylvania. And the last time I checked, we didn't elect people to come to Harrisburg to sit in the halls of the General Assembly of this Commonwealth for the purpose of cutting people's wages and cutting people's benefits. But that's what this is about. You can say it a lot of other ways. But in the end, this is about cutting wages and cutting benefits for people who are trained and skilled at doing work. And, oh, yeah, by the way, what that really is in an era of transparency and accountability that we keep hearing about, that we keep hearing is so important in the utilization of taxpayer funds, this is saying that any job that is worth $185,000 or less is not subject to those kinds of things. And instead, it's just subject to the let my brother-in-law do it.
So we're not going to be bidding anything under $185,000.
Well, it may be bid, but it removes the protection of prevailing wage. So we, instead of using taxpayer dollars to assure that people who are highly skilled and highly trained working on these public works projects are paid at a minimum the wage for their trade or craft that prevails in their community, that's most frequently paid in their community for the work they do, we will say, bid anything you want, and then we're going to finance through taxpayer dollars a race to the bottom by not paying people the minimum wages that exist in our community.
Okay?
This is not about paying Philadelphia wages in Harrisburg or Harrisburg wages in Shippensburg. This is about not paying Shippensburg wages in Shippensburg.
We're paying prevailing wages to all these. We're paying Philly wages to all these legislators here in Harrisburg.
Well, but that's different. You're confused.
I'm confused. How's that?
Well, I ask one of them to explain it to you. I can't explain it to you. I know that the cost of living in Jefferson County is a little bit different than the cost of living in Philadelphia. But a state rep from Jefferson County earns exactly the same amount of money as one who lives in Philadelphia. And, oh, by the way, if either one of them comes to Harrisburg for a day to actually work, they get extra money.
So let me ask you a couple of quick questions, because, you know, it sounds enticing. If we just take this prevailing wage, we were able to cut wages, we can cut construction costs by 30%, and we're going to save all this money.
No. This legislation cuts prevailing wages paid to workers, but it doesn't do anything about cutting construction costs. Construction costs are untouched. If this was not as disingenuous as you and I both know it to be, one of the things that they would be doing would be mandating that 30% cut in every bid of construction costs. But that's not there. This is just reallocating the money that's paid. Indeed, the only evidence that exists about what happens when you cut public construction workers' wages dictates to us, indicates to us that the cost per square foot of school construction, at least, actually not only didn't go down, it went up.
How's that possible? If we're cutting workers' wages, if there's competition and, you know, we're getting the best price for labor, and how can the price go up?
Well, we're not getting the best price for labor. We're getting the cheapest price for labor.
Oh.
And that's different. Okay, that's number one. Number two, because there's nothing in these legislative proposals that requires any impact on construction costs, but only mandates the cut of wages for working men and women in this state, we reallocate from the 99% to the 1%. This is taking money out of our pockets and putting it in the hands of the people who are doing this work.
So to be clear, nothing in House Bill 1329 guarantees me as a taxpayer any savings whatsoever. And in fact, as you're saying, I could actually pay more?
Well, you not only actually could pay more, you will pay more. The only thing that we know that honestly cuts construction costs is bidding and undertaking construction activities when markets are soft and interest rates are low. So right now, at a time when they're proposing to cut workers' wages, what they should be proposing to do is making a big investment in public construction in general, infrastructure in particular, because the cost of money, interest rates, is historically low, the lowest it's ever been in my lifetime.
Never going to be this low again.
It will never be this low again. That cuts construction costs, okay? That cuts actual construction costs. And because the economy is in trouble, contractors are bidding work in a way than the economy was stronger, and they're willing to accept a little bit lower profit, and while they're accepting the lower profit, we are assuring through the prevailing wage law that workers won't be used as a competitive whipsaw as among contractors to cut wages as the method by which to prop up their own profits. So we could save a lot of money right now, maybe as much as 20%. There was an op-ed piece just yesterday in the Harrisburg Patriot authored by an MIT PhD that explains this with crystal clarity, and that the evidence that that PhD relied upon, a PhD in economics, relied upon, demonstrates that in times like these, we can actually save 20% of construction costs simply by bidding work now, as opposed to when construction activity is much higher and contractors are busier and therefore not as hungry for the work.
Right. Now is the time to be doing this.
Now is the time to be doing this. But let's make this clear. This legislation that you're discussing with me right now only guarantees one thing, and it guarantees it absolutely, completely, and beyond peradventure, and that is the slashing of the wages of Pennsylvania's taxpaying construction workers. It doesn't mandate, guarantee, require, or even estimate that $1 of construction costs will actually be saved for the taxpayers who finance these jobs. This is taking money out of working people's pockets and putting it in the 1%'s pockets. That's exactly what it is. I wish there were a better way to say this. I wish there was a nicer way to articulate this, but there isn't.
No, it's
it. This is a legislative wage slash for working people.
This is a ripoff is what it is. Last question I've got for you. You know, we heard the Republicans in November of 2010 when they swept into Washington and here into Harrisburg. Jobs, 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 laser-like focus. This piece of legislation, House Bill 1329, does this create jobs?
To the contrary, it cuts jobs. And it cuts jobs right across the economy, Rick, because when I, as a construction worker, earn less, I buy less. When I buy less, people who make the things I would have otherwise bought work less. I pay less in taxes, so public employees work less. Because I pay less in taxes, my schools suffer. My children suffer. Because I pay less in taxes, my municipal transit authority suffers. Because I pay less in the way of the purchase of goods and services because I can't access things, other sectors of the economy start to fail. And those other sectors of the economy range from everything from utility bills, like electricity and gas, to the local grocery store. And then we have people compelled to make choices between medicine and milk and sugar and shoes. That doesn't grow the economy. That saps the economy. And it saps the economy at a time when we are in a critical, critical mode. This economy is, you know, like that proverbial last straw. We drop one more piece of straw on this and everything falls apart. And they're asking not merely to drop the piece of straw on it, but to use the bully pulpit of the legislative process to pass a law that says we want to destroy the economy, that says we want to slash people's wages, that we want to cut out their access to health care, that we want to destroy their ability to ever have a retirement.
That's why we've got to take action. And if you go to therickSmithShow.com and click on Irwin Aronson's name, it'll take you over to the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO's site where it says, you know, help fight the fight. Put in your zip code into the little button there, and it will contact your representative and tell them that you oppose House Bill 1329, as we all should. Irwin, I appreciate the time and the information. Always great talking to you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again next week, I hope.
All righty. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? What do you think? Should we be slashing wages? Should we be stealing? I hope not. Back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Double Dippin' Joe is back in the news. Double Dip is not some soda jerk working in an ice cream shop, but that's not too far off. He's a state legislator working in Texas to jerk taxpayers around for his own financial gain. For years, Representative Joe Driver was just another obscure doolittle Texas right-winger. He kept getting elected in his solidly Republican district by ranting ceaselessly against the bugaboo of excessive government spending. But late last year, Joe flared for a brief moment into national notoriety as a blue-ribbon example of legislative hubris, stupidity, hypocrisy, cynicism on a stick. He got caught double-billing for some $60,000 in travel expenses, getting reimbursed by both his campaign fund and Texas taxpayers. In defense, the 20-year-old legislative veteran, who, by the way, serves on the Appropriations Committee, entered a plea of stupidity. If I knew it was wrong, he said, I wouldn't have done it that way. Imagine a common robber trying that defense. But then, robbers have ethics, whereas lawmakers just have power. Joe has now cut a deal with prosecutors. A $5,000 fine, repay what he stole, plead guilty to the felony, and get 5 years probation. That's it. No jail time. Plus, he gets to serve out the remaining year of his legislative term. Yes, Texas law allows convicted felons to stay in office. And at the end of his probation, his conviction gets wiped off the books. Wait, there's more. Driver, who piously assails government spending on other people, gets to keep his state pension. So the taxpayers he ripped off will be sending $57,000 a year to Double Dippin' Joe for the rest of his life. You see, crime does pay, if you're one of the powerful elite. This is Jim Hightower saying, and legislators like Driver wonder why common robbers are held in higher public esteem than they are.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me here, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, if we could only live in conservative world. I mean, really, if we just dropped all of that, I care about my neighbor. Just go back to good old fashioned, back to the 90s. Take us back to the 90s. Take us back to the 1890s. Back to when the conservative ideology ruled the land. When those children went to work. You know, kind of like Newt Gingrich wants to set up, you know, get those kids back to work. Get those poor kids cleaning toilets. Get them back to work. Setting up the little apprentice program. The apprentice! Oh, that lottery ticket winnings. Yes! Well, the folks over at Human Rights Watch, they released a report yesterday saying that between 20,000 and 40,000 children work in the artisanal gold mines in Mali, Africa, which is the third largest producer of gold in the world. The Human Rights Watch statement said children as young as six years old are digging mine shafts, working underground, pulling up heavy weights of ore, and carry crush and pan ore as well. Kids interviewed as young as six regularly complain of back, head, neck, arm, and joint injuries, as well as coughing and respiratory diseases. But you know what? They're making profit. $218 million worth, according to the group. And I go back and I go, you know, exactly what are we doing? What are we doing in this country? I mean, you got Gingrich running around saying, well, our child labor laws are truly stupid. We want our 6 and 7 year old kids competing with mom and dad to get the janitor job. Is that conservative world? I mean, really stop and think about where the right wants to take us. And I look at this story down in Florida and just grab me by the neck. Again, Obion County, Tennessee. Woman comes home, finds her mobile home on fire. Does what you're supposed to do, call 911. Hey, come quick. Fire department comes out, says, oh, gee, you're outside the boundary. You didn't pay your annual fee. We're going to stand here and watch your house burn down. She's going to watch it burn down. And then you think, you know, what exactly is the core function of government? You know, we keep hearing the Republicans talking about, oh, the liquor stores, that's not in the core function of government. Well, I think safety is. I think protecting the public is. I think making sure dangerous substances are semi-controlled. I think that is in the purview of the government. And putting out fires. Protecting children from abuses, protecting workers. I think those are all core functions of government, don't you? And I look at down in Alabama, you know, across the country, you've got these fire departments who are saying, well, you know, let's start charging people. Instead of taxing them, oh, we'll just have a voluntary fee and you can gamble. Or if you don't have the money, like these people lived in a trailer park, they don't have they're like, we don't have any money. We haven't had jobs. So I guess in conservative world, if you can't pay for protection, well, you're out on your own. I mean, to me, this fire department thing sounds like a protection racket. If it were me going out there saying, well, you know, I'll protect you only if you pay me, you'd throw me in jail, wouldn't you? Let's just throw your things up and say, hey, we're a county fire department. Now I look at this story in Alabama. Since they've run all the immigrants out of Alabama, they've got no one to pick their crops. So, what have they decided? we're going to use prison labor instead. So we've run out all of the undocumented workers. They're claiming 120,000 that they've run out. So, great idea. Go use the prisoners. And, you know, part of me says, you know, they've got to be thrilled that Bill Clinton was president, passing three strikes and you're out. Plenty of cheap labor. And, you know, it comes back to what does our government do? What should we be protecting workers or should we choose prisoners? What's the core function? What I love hearing libertarians, especially the local talk idiot in this area, who rails about how much he hates government, and then, well, why doesn't the government do something about that? And this next story, when we come back, this next story I want to talk about, I think is one of those. This woman, you know, wants to send her kid to a private school, but not happy that there's a lengthy bus ride. My thoughts when we come back, and I got to tell you, this is just amazing to me, and it's only going to get worse as we move forward talking about education. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away. They're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions, it's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org. And from all of us at AFSCME, happy holidays.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So I see this article yesterday, and it was one of those things that grabbed me that I didn't have time to talk about yesterday. It was late in the evening when they put it out, and I'm going, man, I just can't wait to come in here and rail against this because it's dumb. This woman says, oh, my poor children. Oh, they take 90 minutes to get home from the bus trip. Oh, they get on the bus, and it's 90 minutes. My poor little darlings. Because she sends her kids to a private school. And according to the state law, if the bus is in the area, if they transport regular education students of the same grade to public schools, they have to do it to private. As long as the private schools operate at not-for-profit status, they still have to provide it. It has to be within 10 miles, and they've got to do it. And if I understand correctly, even if they have to provide it, even if the public school doesn't have school and the private school does. So they've got the public school bus, the transportation has to meet the private school needs. Okay? So if the public school says, you know what, we're going to take a day off for in service, they've still got to provide transportation for the kids to go to the private school. So I listened to this. The woman says, the shortest route from my house to the school is only 6 miles. And it takes my little Trevor and Annie, oh, it takes them, and Ian, it takes them, oh, it takes them so long. 90 minutes. They're so tired and sweaty and unhappy. And my first thought was, if you're only 6 miles away, put down the bonbons and get the car and go get them. I mean, if you can afford to send them to private school, you can afford to go get them. Or, you know what, maybe here's an idea. Ask one of the other parents at the private school, hey, can you drop off little so-and-so and so-and-so here at the house? Yeah, I'll pay you a buck or two to do it. Oh, no, no, no. Because we've got this, again, these idiots here in Harrisburg. Oh, we gotta provide transportation. See, her kids go to this East Pennsboro area school district. So, of course, this school's within 10 miles. So, you know, they gotta throw these kids on the bus. And, in fact, I guess this school district has 121 of these kids, which cost the school district. And this blew my mind. Absolutely blew my mind. For 121 kids, it costs $115,000 to transport them back and forth to school. Because the private school kids, it costs $953 per student to get them back and forth to school, as opposed to the $313 for the public school. So you got all these religious schools who, oh, we got to take little Johnny and so-and-so to school. So you've got the mother who's complaining, it's 90 minutes. Then you read down in the article and you find out why it's 90 minutes. Evidently, the Good Shepherd School and the Trinity High School and the Bible Baptist School, they all have different dismissal times. So the bus gets over there and got to wait. So now you got all of these kids inconvenienced because, oh, well, you know, this school, they've got a different dismissal time, or they're going to be later, or they're going to be later. And you got to wait because you got to get little Johnny or Susie home. So the people are saying, well, you should add a fourth bus. The school district's going, wait a minute, we're broke. We don't have that kind of money. If we added a fourth bus, it would add another $40,000 a year to what it costs to move these private kids anyway. Can't do it. It's too much money. So, you know, all those people out there screaming and complaining, oh, we need to cut school budgets. Here's a good place to start. If you can afford to get your kid to private school, here's an idea. Figure out how to get them back and forth. Just figure that out. And what really irks my behind is all of these different schools have different dismissal times. Instead of going to the school district, and the reason this is to me an anti-government argument, is the people go to the people, to the entity that they can beat up on, which is the public school. Because they're not going to go argue with the private school. Private school says, you don't like it, get your kid the heck out of here. Understand where we're going educationally. Down the road, that's what's going to happen. You don't like it, take your kid and go. So they're beating up on the public school for not accommodating of the needs to these handful of private students. This is where we're going, folks. Stop and think about how much money, and you go, oh, well, it's only a couple of bucks to take them back and forth. According to the State Department of Education, to get kids back and forth in private schools to their home to school, to their private school, costs we, the taxpayers, $170 million in 2009-2010 school year. Stop and think about that. $170 million. How many programs got cut because of $170 million? How many? I mean, you know, the article said, do you think it's good for children to be on the bus so long? No, I don't. I don't think it's good for kids at all. In fact, if it were me or I were the parent, 6 minutes, I'd go pick up my own kid. Or I'd complain to the private school, hey, here's an idea. Why don't you change the schedule? Just nuts. This is what we're doing. We're privatizing all this stuff, and I'm telling you, we're going to get screwed. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Lori on line one. How are you doing tonight, Lori?
Good. How are you doing, Rick?
I am terrific. What's going on?
I just came from the Education Reform Town Hall meeting that was sponsored by two of our state representatives, Grell and DeLosier.
Oh, how'd that go?
It was pretty interesting. I mean, you know, I do a lot of work with, teachers and unions and things like that, but there was a statistic on vouchers that I did not know that pretty much just freaked me out. And did you know that 65% of all the money that will go to vouchers will not go to students at public schools, it'll go to parents of kids who are already enrolled in private schools?
Yeah, I knew that.
I get it.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't mean. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's the point. I mean, to me, that's the reason all this. That's the reason the Catholic Church has said nothing about the wine and spirit shops. But that's a whole other argument.
Yeah, they're all for school choice, right?
Absolutely.
Choice, that's interesting.
In fact, if you saw the story from Pittsburgh, the diocese out there wanted to send a letter to every kid who was getting any type of aid from the church, telling their parents, you better go call your legislator, and you better write down when you talk to them, what they said, or you're getting no money next year.
I saw that. Well, and then so this is supposed to help the poor kids, right? In the public schools, only 9%. This is according to the Pennsylvania League of Women Voters, Sharon Kletzian. 9% of our tax dollars are going to go to the kids that it's supposed to go to.
I'm surprised it's that much. I mean, you know,
yep.
To be honest, I mean, honest, Lori, I mean, did anybody there really think that this was about really helping those kids who are struggling?
Oh, we heard from people who certainly thought so. Secretary Tamales certainly made that pitch.
I mean, you're going to give these kids these golden tickets. You're going to give them these wonderful lottery tickets. You've won. Hooray. Here's your prize. Where are they going to go? I mean, I'm looking at the charter schools that are there now. I'm looking at some of the startup private schools around the country. I'm not seeing success. I'm sorry. Just not seeing it.
Yeah. And speaking of charter schools, I also just learned this, that in York, for instance, they've already got 8 charter schools right there. Next year, it's going to, what the city school district has to pay charter schools is $25 million. They've got a funding hole right now of $19 million. If it wasn't for charter schools, they'd be $6 million in the black.
Jeez, oh, man. Let me ask you this. I got about a minute here.
Sure.
General feeling of the room. Did you get the general feeling of the people who came? Not the pundits, not the advocates, the people who showed up in the room. General feeling pro against pro?
You know what? Cumberland Valley is a great school district. I mean, they had the new member of the school board stood up and she spoke so beautifully about wanting to know how this is going to help these poor kids. And she was just terrific. Barbara is her name. There were so many wonderful, you know, there were a lot of teachers who came out, you know, because they believe in public education.
Yep.
And they spoke passionately about it. They were terrific. It was, and a lot of parents very concerned. It was a great crowd. It really
excellent.
Was.
Excellent. That's what I wanted to hear. I was hoping that it wasn't packed with a bunch of paid activists from the Tinky Tank over here at the Commonwealth Foundation or the billionaire people at Students First, that euphemistically named group. So good.
Right.
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you, Lori.
There are a couple. So take care, Rick.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the call. Quick break back after this with Sharon Ward from the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. You want to talk about a screw job? This is Marcellus Shale. Another screw, and we're getting back after this.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union says it's not supporting a planned December 12th shutdown of West Coast ports organized by the Occupy movement. The union sent a memo to its members and leaders that said in part, quote, to be clear, the ILWU, the Coast Longshore Division, and Local 21 are not coordinating independently or in conjunction with any self-proclaimed organization or group to shut down any port or terminal, particularly as it relates to our dispute with EGT in Longview, end quote. ILWU International President Robert McElrath says that the ILWU, quote, shares the Occupy Wall Street movement's concerns about corporate abuses and the future of the middle class, but we must be clear that any actions organized by outside groups, including the proposed December 12th shutdown of various terminals on the West Coast, have not been vetted by our union's democratically led process, end quote. ILWU Local 10 President Richard Mead says its members should take guidance from this memo. He says Local 10 members have the right to speak freely and to assemble, but should make it clear that they aren't speaking officially for the ILWU when they do so. The Occupy movement says the ILWU is prevented by contracts from authorizing a port shutdown, but Occupy says if enough protesters converge on the ports, an arbitrator will decide on the spot if it's safe for ILWU members to work. If it isn't, the workers will be sent home with pay. Thousands of protesters are in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back the Capitol action. Carl Morrow is a Wisconsin SEIU member, one of many activists who have been trying to meet with U.S. Representative Paul Ryan. They sat in at Ryan's office.
There's lots of people that are out here now. We have about, I would say, maybe 50 to 75 people, and we're going to sit here as long as it's taken until, you know, he shows up, and we'll be here all week doing the same thing until somebody talks to us. We've been in Kenosha, where his office is. We've done rallies there. We've put in dozens of calls to his office, and still no response.
Edward Jude is also with SEIU in Milwaukee.
We're trying to let our political leaders know the importance of them bringing jobs back into the community and trying to let them know our needs.
The current owner of the Upper Big Branch mine will pay $200 million to settle civil and criminal penalties in that mining disaster that killed 29 miners in April of 2010. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the payment from Alpha Natural Resources is a welcome beginning, but Trumka says it's far from the end of the justice that the miners and their families deserve. Trumka says the disaster was caused by corporate greed winning out over safety precautions. Trumka is calling for stiff jail sentences for those responsible for the disaster. This newscast made possible in part by the United Mine Workers of America and by the United Steel Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
November 2012, we don't get sucked in like we did in November of 2010, and we don't get fooled again. You look at what they did, they're doing here at the Capitol, here in Harrisburg. It's an absolute crime. Just an absolute crime. And again, you know, they're good at politicking, they're good at campaigning, they're wonderful at bumper stickers, slogans. Governing, not so much. You look at the latest story I saw in the AP story. They said that, according to the Department of Revenue, we were going to bring in about $102 million in personal income tax from the shale. Going to get all these royalties. We're going to big money. What did we actually get? About $46 million. Less than half. I mean, if you could probably throw a dart and gotten a better guess than that. So I've asked Sharon Ward, director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, to come talk about what's going on with this shale screw job. Sharon, thanks for taking time for me.
Anytime, Rick. Happy to do it.
Thanks. You know, I look at this. $102 million, they said. We're gonna get all this money. What'd they get?
They didn't get what they said they were going to get. But here's the problem, Rick. We're happy that there's, you know, that there's drilling activity. We're happy for the jobs, but the industry, and with the help now under the Corbett administration of the Department of Revenue, continues to make overinflated claims about their economic impact, about the number of jobs, about how much tax revenue they're bringing in. And the reason they do this is because they use it as a hammer to prevent protections for the environment, to prevent any kind of regulation, to prevent demands for hiring Pennsylvania workers. So that's why they're doing it. And in reality, they are not benefiting the economy the way they claim.
You know, I look at my representative, teabagger Stephen Bloom, who with his connection, I gotta give him credit. He does send me an email every once in a while, a nice video. I'm sure they spent a lot of money on it. But they said in the video that Pennsylvania, thanks to the drillers, they've created 88,000 jobs through 2010. And I'm going, really, 88,000 jobs? Is that possible?
No, it's not. If you look at the actual number of jobs that have been created in drilling in the core drilling industries, it's about 9,000. And it's very hard to get an accurate study of this because much of the research is funded by the industry. But the best study that I've seen is from Penn State, not the bad Penn State people, some good Penn State researchers that we trust. It's about 22,000 jobs. Look, we need jobs in Pennsylvania. There's no doubt about it. But the share of jobs that have been created is like 0.1% of all the jobs in the Commonwealth.
Right.
It's not. We need to continue the payroll tax reduction for middle class families, and we need a real jobs policy. And you know, this is not going to do it. This is not going to turn the economy around for us.
Yeah, but I look at this. He claims 88,000 jobs, and he claims that it's created jobs in Cumberland County. I didn't know there was any drilling going on in Cumberland County.
What they do is take any jobs that have been created in certain classifications and claim that those are jobs created by the Marcellus Shale industries, and that's not the case.
Darts at the wall. All right.
Yeah.
So what about the claim that he makes in his communications to me that it's put $8 billion into our economy?
Rick, I have to tell you, the numbers, it's like a game of telephone. Every time a number comes out, it gets whispered to the next person, and it grows. So I got to say, this is an example of overheated rhetoric and overstated claims. I haven't added $8 billion into the economy.
So he basically just reached behind him and popped out a number.
There seems to be a lot of that going on. Look, again, we think it's important. We think that the gas industry is bringing jobs. It is contributing some tax revenue, but you got to look at the Department of Revenue. If you look at the actual numbers that they put out after they've certified them, they're much more modest than the overheated claims that you hear.
Right.
So they really got caught, to be honest with you. They came up with these wild estimates for how much money the gas industry was going to generate, both in the personal income tax and also for small companies. And the numbers were nowhere near what they had argued. The other thing that revenue did talk about was the personal income tax that's collected from companies that are organized not as corporations but organized as small businesses. And that's about $10 million. That's really a tiny amount for an industry that's supposed to be contributing $8 billion to our economy.
Yeah, that sounds like almost nothing. And I was, you know, if you listen to the rhetoric going up to the 2010 election, you know, this was going to be our savior. These jobs, and look, we need the jobs. And I think it's a great idea that we're moving forward as long as we can do it in a safe way and protect the environment and not make me hold the bag when we have to clean all this up. I'm okay with it.
That's right.
But I look at what's going up on up in Dimmick right now, where the company that Cabot was supposed to be paying these people water for permanently because they destroyed their water, walked away from it and said, well, we don't have to do it anymore.
Well, I had a chance to go up to Dimmick and visit some of the houses that have over the past year and a half been getting water from Cabot. And I have to tell you, it's scary. They've got these methane meters on their front lawns, and sometimes when you walk over to them, you can actually smell the methane. What we're seeing is the industry unwilling to take responsibility for its impacts, using every trick in the book to try and prevent, you know, try to keep from taking any responsibility for the problems that they're causing. And again, you can manage this. We need good setbacks. We need strong environmental laws. We need them to come clean. The other problem they have is in places like Dimmick and in southwest Pennsylvania, when they are contaminating wells, they're compensating families, but they're making them sign non-disclosure agreements. So we can't really get an accurate bead on just what they're doing to people because they're hidden behind this veil of secrecy.
Amazing. And you look at the legislation, as weak as it's been, that's come out. And I think we're already behind the eight ball. Some people have argued that our environmental policies are in line and they're going to be able to take care of things. I tend to disagree. But you know, that being said, you know, I look at what Bloom also said in his communication to me, saying, well, we need to be competitive because, you know, Ohio's trying to take jobs away from us. So we need to, you know, relax those regulations, relax some standards. And to me, it just seems like more of a race to the bottom. How much are we willing to give away and how little are we willing to want to benefit from it?
Rick, you have it exactly right. They are playing this race to the bottom game. If we don't tax, if we have no environmental regulations, we're going to get more of these jobs. Let's face it, that's not what's driving the industry. What's driving the industry is, where's the gas? Where do they have the leases? Where are they close to market? So no. I mean, look at West Virginia. There's a gas boom going on in West Virginia, and they've got a 6% tax. So our elected officials giving away the store and not looking out for our interests.
Well, let me ask you that. I mean, West Virginia has, you said, a 6% tax. The governor in his budget speech said he wanted to be like Texas. If we had just the tax that Texas has or the tax that West Virginia has anyone done any mock-up of what we would be getting if we just had one of those two tax structures?
Yeah, actually, we have, Rick. We've compared the tax rate that is included in either the House or the Senate bill with Texas. So for a typical well, for the same well in Texas, we'd be getting five times more in tax revenue than what we're getting under the House plan, and about two and a half times more revenue than under the Senate plan. So I'd be thrilled if we were like Texas, because we'd have a reasonably good tax rate and local governments would be able to collect property taxes that could help them to pay for some of the damage caused by the industry.
So why aren't we pursuing that? I mean, you know, what I'm seeing is fairly weak and really not, what doesn't seem to be much money to me.
Well, you know, Common Cause released a report a couple of weeks ago that talked about the contributions from the gas industry to Pennsylvania's elected officials. And Governor Corbett's contributions are over $1 million. So you've got to see some link between the industry's lavish spreading around of the campaign dollars and the General Assembly's lack of effective regulation of the industry.
You know, and $1 million sounds like a lot of money. I mean, really, it kind of does. But when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, what the drilling industry is going to get for that meager investment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wish I could put every penny that I've ever touched in my life into that kind of investment.
Well, I'll tell you, every well in Pennsylvania, or the average well, so across time, the average well in Pennsylvania is going to generate $16 million in revenue. So there's a lot of money here. And you're right. $1 million is very, it's important to a campaign, but it's a drop in the bucket for these companies.
So last line of questioning here. As the expert here, as the director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, where should we be going with this? I mean, I look to the good socialist state of Alaska, where the citizens of the state actually benefit when the oil is being pulled out of the ground. What's the right direction? If you had the ability to write some policy, where would we be going with this instead of where we seem to be going?
I don't know. Maybe we need to get Sarah Palin in here. She kicked the industry's butt when she was governor of Alaska. So maybe we need to bring her in here, and she can stand up to the gas companies, because our guys certainly are.
Maybe that is the answer. So Sarah for governor in 2014.
Something like that.
There you go. Sharon Ward, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the information.
Happy to do it, Rick.
All righty. Sharon Ward, director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. You can go to their website with the link from ours at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Right. The Rick's Smith Show.
Double Dippin' Joe is back in the news. Double Dip is not some soda jerk working in an ice cream shop, but that's not too far off. He's a state legislator working in Texas to jerk taxpayers around for his own financial gain. For years, Representative Joe Driver was just another obscure doolittle Texas right-winger. He kept getting elected in his solidly Republican district by ranting ceaselessly against the bugaboo of excessive government spending. But late last year, Joe flared for a brief moment into national notoriety as a blue-ribbon example of legislative hubris, stupidity, hypocrisy, cynicism on a stick. He got caught double-billing for some $60,000 in travel expenses, getting reimbursed by both his campaign fund and Texas taxpayers. In defense, the 20-year-old legislative veteran, who, by the way, serves on the Appropriations Committee, entered a plea of stupidity. "If I knew it was wrong," he said, "I wouldn't have done it that way." Imagine a common robber trying that defense. But then, robbers have ethics, whereas lawmakers just have power. Joe has now cut a deal with prosecutors. A $5,000 fine, repay what he stole, plead guilty to the felony, and get 5 years probation. That's it. No jail time. Plus, he gets to serve out the remaining year of his legislative term. Yes, Texas law allows convicted felons to stay in office. And at the end of his probation, his conviction gets wiped off the books. Wait, there's more. Driver, who piously assails government spending on other people, gets to keep his state pension. So the taxpayers he ripped off will be sending $57,000 a year to Double Dippin' Joe for the rest of his life. You see, crime does pay, if you're one of the powerful elite. This is Jim Hightower saying, and legislators like Driver wonder why common robbers are held in higher public esteem than they are.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to the website and download our podcast there for your entertainment and enjoyment. Or, if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So, you know, I was looking at this article in the New York Times, and it's talking about public sector workers who are retiring sooner. And if you've got the time, if I were a public sector worker, if I worked for a state or any, I'd be gathering the sheep and getting the flock out, taking my pension and going. The way in this country we've been treating public sector workers, I wouldn't want to work for the state. Really, I wouldn't. I mean, every time you turn on the news, every time you look at a report, it's always, oh, that was greedy. Understand, retirement's, I think it was like $24,000 a year is what they get for retirement. I would take my retirement and I would go somewhere else. You know, it reminds me of when we were in Wisconsin and I went to go get my oil changed over at the one tire place there. And the guy in front of me was a state worker there in Madison. And he was talking to the guy behind the counter who I guess was the owner. And he was telling him, yeah, I'm retiring and I get my pension. I think he had like $25,000 a year, whatever he said. And then I'm going to do the job that I've been doing for the last 30 years. Because evidently the state was privatizing things. He volunteered to retire to take this job in the private sector, doing the exact thing he was doing for the state for a lot less money. So when I got up to pay my bill, the guy who owned the place or who was behind the counter said, he was really visibly miffed that this guy was going to retire, collect a pension, and then go do the job that he was doing before. You know, how can he be able to collect a pension and do the job? And, you know, the guy was really ticked off about it. He was ticked off by the fact that this guy was going to go work while collecting his pension. Not that the job that the guy was doing for the state in the new position was going to pay twice as much as it did for the state. That didn't seem to bother the guy. So the guy was going to, he's going to leave his job at the state, go for a private company pay, who's going to pay him twice as much, and he's going to collect his pension. I don't blame the guy. I would have left too. And the guy across the counter, he was not upset in the least that that job that he was doing for the state, that guy was doing for the state, was now paying double in the private sector. We don't like hearing those stories. And we're going to see a lot more of this in the coming years because a lot of these public sector workers are going, I don't want to put up with this nonsense. You know, these people are dedicated to the state. They work their behinds off. And for what? The compromise used to be you're not going to make a lot of money, but you're going to get a decent pension. It's going to be decent. It's going to be maybe a little bit better than the private sector, but you know what? You're going to make a lot less money than they do in the private sector. And you're going to get decent health care benefits because you've got such a large buying pool. And that was the trade-off. Well, now that the economy has taken a nosedive, thanks to the private sector crashing the economy, now people are looking to these public sector workers who for years have been just horrendously underpaid and saying, well, you got health care. You shouldn't have that because I don't have it. And you've got a pension and you shouldn't have it because, well, I don't have it. And I'm telling you, you're going to start seeing, and you want to know that you want to make this pension situation worse? I mean, I keep hearing people complain about the state pension funds. You want to make it worse? Have people start retiring early and start pulling money out early. I mean, it's bad enough that we didn't pay into the state didn't pay into the pension fund for at least a decade. Never mind that. Never mind that it collapsed, we had the collapse in September of 2008. Never mind that. But wait till you see the mass exodus of people who are going, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah, you know, I have the opportunity since we're down here in Harrisburg to talk to state workers every once in a while, and you can see it. Some of them are beaten down over this. I wouldn't want to do it. I'll tell you that. I would not want to work for the state or local government or the federal government at all with all the attacks going on against them. Just wouldn't want to do it. And I won't. I mean, I'm thankful that they're there. They do a great job, but at the end of the day, man, I want no part of it. No part whatsoever. And you look at what's going on here. I mean, we've got these legislators who nothing that is you belongs to you or me, we the people. Nothing is sacred. Everything's on the auction block. Everything's for sale. And the question is, you know, what do we want from our government? I mean, Tennessee, you got the fire department. They're not coming to your house unless you pay for it. In Georgia, they're going to use prison labor to put out their fires. Alabama, to pick the crops, let's use prisoners. Instead of slavery, we're just going to use prisoners everywhere. Don't you have a problem with that? I know I do. Because I have this view of government, our government, of, for, and by we the people. Not some evil entity, not the government, our government. It's us. And when it functions poorly, it's a reflection of all of us. You know, I look at what's going on now, and we better get our act together as a nation. And the clowns in Washington and here in Harrisburg who can't seem to figure out how to govern, well, you throw them out and you get people who can. Doesn't that seem sensible? Because government is supposed to be where we do those things that individually we can't. Like we end hunger. We end homelessness. We make sure that everyone has health care. We make sure everyone gets a good quality education. We defend the nation from foreign threats. The things we individually cannot do, our government, through us, does. Education being right up there at the top. And we're seeing all the attacks on public education. And we know the numbers that are out there. You know, there's a study in Indiana that, you know, said, you know, if you lose them by third grade, they actually predicted based on how on student achievement through third grade, how many people were going to go to prison. You look at the number of people who don't graduate from high school who end up in prison. In fact, I was just reading a story today that said, you know, someone who drops out of high school, they're going to make a whole lot less on average than someone who just went to high school. And they're actually going to cost the taxpayer. And in fact, the report that they came out with said it was going to cost the taxpayer something like $71,000 over their working life, because they're not going to be paying taxes. They're going to actually be reaping benefits back. And the numbers they gave, they said a high school graduate pays $236,000 more in taxes than they receive in benefits. A college graduate receives over almost $900,000, pays more in taxes, almost $900,000 more in taxes than they get back in benefits. So, I mean, you could make an economic imperative why we need to keep people in school and invest in quality education. Now, you look at Illinois, for instance. They're saying is the fifth most populous state. 13 million residents. Almost 12% of them, of the adults, 19 to 24, dropouts. 15% of that age group in Chicago, dropouts. And you look at their prison system. 51% of all the people locked up in the Illinois prisons, high school dropouts. I'm of the mindset that we need to catch these kids early. We need to invest in education now, because it's like the guy says, pay me now or pay me later. And how much do we spend locking people up? But I guess there's part of me that says the conservative class wants it this way. They want to destroy public education. They want to make those numbers worse. They want that 51% of prisoners being dropouts go up to 70%. Why? Because we need cheap labor. We need exploitable labor. And if they get away with it in Georgia, if they get away with it in Alabama, you bet you're behind. Eventually, it's coming right here. And those jobs, well, those jobs may be yours. They may be mine. And what's that going to do for our economy? It is frustrating beyond belief. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ron Demichelli, president of AFGE Local 1916 out in Pittsburgh. Again, you know, I look at this Republican plan to pass the middle-class tax cuts. What a screw job. Back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The following message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aging. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseloads, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our senior citizens suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so. But now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, my bosses knew would leave. We had layoffs again this morning. I got more children now than I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become the problem? How did fault become all mine? The governor says they're tightening their belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Well, that seems to be the absolute truth. The only belts that are being tightened are those who... Well, the people who are working for a living, the people who are work with their hands. Yeah, you know, the guy that I heard the other day on Book TV, he was talking about his book down in Alabama, and he said, you know, in this country, people who work with their hands for a living, they really have no champions left. And I would argue that the American labor movement still is that champion, and they have to be again. But it's going to take all of us coming together. And I look at what's going on in Washington. I don't know anybody who makes their living through the ache of their back or the sweat of their brow can vote for one of these Republicans in good conscience. The idea that we cannot get this payroll tax, we can't get this extended for 95% of the people in this country without having to give our pound of flesh, be it, you know, freezing wages of federal workers or this repatriation of the $1.5 trillion the investor classes stored overseas. Got to give our pound of flesh. What happened? We're not in favor of raising taxes. That used to be what Republicans were for. Nuts. Anyway, I've asked Ron Demicelli. He's the president of AFGE Local 1916 out in Allegheny County out there in Pittsburgh to come talk to us about this wage freeze and some of the other stuff going on with federal employees. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, the Republicans are, you know, they're playing games with this payroll tax. And, you know, I kind of get it. It's the games they play. But as a federal worker, you know, five-year pay freeze?
Well, you know, Rick, we've had 2 years already, which translates into $60 billion. And I think that's a pretty good contribution that federal employees have already made to the effort. And federal employees, like other Americans, are not opposed to sacrifice to help their country, but we need something that's fair and balanced.
Yeah, we keep hearing about, oh, we need shared sacrifice, but yet I look to Wall Street, I look to the billionaire class, I look to the Koch brothers, and I see they're doing just fine, thank you very much. It's you and I who are struggling.
Oh, that's correct. And, you know, and the American people need to understand that, you know, the American Federation of Government Employees, and we represent people such as the nurses and the great professional people at the VA hospitals, the DOD depots that are sending and shipping supplies and weapons and ammunition to the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, Social Security reps, BOP corrections officers, and Border Patrol. I mean, these are some great people doing great jobs for the American public.
So Border Patrol guards, I mean, let's stop and think about this for a second. They're talking about building a fence. The state senator there in Arizona wants to take up a collection to build a fence that most people know is not going to work, but we're going to freeze the pay of the people who are actually out there on the border. Does that make any sense?
No, that makes no sense at all. And it's another 2 or 3 year freeze. I mean, this is just phenomenal. And not only that, they want to cut what they contribute to our pensions and or make us contribute more to our pensions. And they've convinced the American people we've got federal employees have these great benefit programs. Let me give you a for instance. When I tell people they don't believe, when I tell them, like, with health care, the, you know, the federal employee pays 40% of his payments to his health care plan.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Ron. I would make the argument the worker pays 100% to the plan in deferred compensation. Those are wages you should have been getting. I mean, that's the thing most people don't seem to grasp. You're working for a wage, and some of that wage, you say, yeah, my employer, please give me health care, and please give me a pension. I'll defer some of my wages.
Exactly.
But all of it is part of how much you should be paid.
Exactly.
And what's going on, what I find with most people when you talk about health care especially, they point to the federal workers or state workers, they're angry that you've got it because they don't. Instead of saying, how do I get it, they're saying, well, you shouldn't have it.
Oh, there's no doubt about that, you know, and I say that quite often, people that, you know, sadly, the America that I was born into and started to grow up in is not the America that I know today.
Let me ask you this. As I'm sure you've worked for the government for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we freeze their pay for your pay for the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of people are we going to be able to recruit in the future when you're making pennies on the dollar? What kind of people are we going to get? What kind of quality are you going to end up with?
Well, that's exactly right, and you know, and that's the hypocrisy of the Republicans in the right wing. They, on one hand, they talk about they want the best and the brightest in the government, and on the other hand, they talk about, you know, multi-year wage freezes and benefit reductions.
Yeah, I got the Border Patrol guy on my brain. You're going to tell me that you're going to send a guy out on the border all by himself, 3 o'clock in the morning, to go chase people up and down for basically nothing? Really? That's the America that we're putting forth?
That's exactly right. And I'll give you another example. The BOP corrections officers. You know what, Rick? I've been in one of those federal prisons in just for a tour on one day. Well, I was glad to get out of there. Those guys have to go and do that job every day.
Yeah, you couldn't pay me enough. But
me either.
No, but there are people that do those jobs, and they do them quite effectively, and they're career people. You know, here's what bothers me. You know, we have gotten since since the advent of Reagan, and really since the collapse in September of 2008, we've gotten accustomed to pointing our fingers at other people and saying, you don't deserve because I don't have. Somehow we need to turn that around and say, you know what? And I think it's happening. As you look around this country, we're seeing people out in the streets saying, it's that 1%. And if you look at the numbers bore it out. This redistribution of wealth that has happened over the last 30 years, the wages that you and I used to make, going to the Koch brothers, going to the Coors and the Mellon Scaifes and the billionaire class.
Well, there's no doubt about that. You know what I mean? It's just, and I agree with you. You know, I agree with you. You know, and that's what I said earlier, that, hey, when I was a youngster and a young man, you know, I come from a working class neighborhood. My father worked construction. You know, when you saw somebody had a good job with good benefits, you said to yourself, man, how do I aspire to be there? How do I get there? And you found out what you had to do to get there, and you did that, you know. And I never ever heard my father begrudge any working man pay or anything. Now it's just like you said, it's not like, hey, how do I get there? It's like, you have it, I don't have it, so therefore you don't deserve it, and I need to drag you down here with me.
So you guys at the AFGE are on the national level doing an ad campaign called Explain It To Me GOP. In fact, the website, explainittomegop.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Ron Domenichelli's name. It'll take you over there. You can take a look at it. What's the idea behind this?
The idea behind it, Rick, is we're asking people, you know, look, why, we support the payroll tax reduction for another year to help American working families, but to balance that, that's why they want to freeze our wages another 2 to 3 years to pay for it, and we don't understand why the Border Patrol officer who's risking his life and the workers in DOD depots that are working hard. Why does it have to come out of our hind ends to pay for that cut?
Absolutely.
It's hypocrisy.
Absolutely. And what bothers me is, you know, they'll take it out of your hide. But boy, you ask something from the billionaire class, you ask something from Wall Street, forget it.
Well, exactly. And you know, and not only that, you know, what they're going to do to these agencies, you know, in this coming fiscal year and beyond, they're going to destroy another couple hundred thousand jobs on the federal side. That's only going to contribute to hurting the economy more.
Now, here's what bothers me. We have put people who, right to our faces, have told us that they despise government, they don't believe in government of, for, and by we the people, and they're going to destroy it, and yet we voted for them. Well, you and I didn't, but as a nation, we voted these people in.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You know, and like I said, you have more people. We have, you know, the food inspectors. You know, look over the last few years. How many incidents do we need to hear about tainted food supplies
Don't get me started about food. I'll go absolutely ballistic if I have to talk about the NAFTA and the most recent country of origin labeling that we just got screwed on in the secret tribunal because of NAFTA. You know, in this country, we're not allowed to mandate that the Mexicans and the Canadians have to write where the beef comes from. You and I, evidently, we're not adult enough to know that, hey, this beef's from Mexico. Because this secret tribunal has decided that that's an unfair trade barrier. I'm missing that one. But that's an argument for a whole nother day. But, you know, getting back to this, you know, the reality is we need to be pursuing policy that's good for people like you and me, and we need to get the working class of this country to wake up and realize that. I want to be in the investor class someday, but why not make this part of it better before I get there?
Well, and I think the campaign you're seeing that just got kicked off that you referred to in AFGE, we're going to
explain it to me. GOP.org is the website.
Exactly. We're going to continue to tell our story. And you know what? We need to tell our story to the American people, what it is that government employees do for them. And I think once they realize that, you know, I think they'll start to come around, you know, and have a higher opinion of federal workers.
Isn't that something that you should have been doing all along, though, Ron? I mean, as labor as a whole, I think has a problem that they didn't tell their story enough, and they let the people who were out to destroy them kind of frame the message before they even got to the fight.
Well, there's no doubt about it, but it goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, it's you know what, Rick? I've got over 30 years in the government, and I hardly remember having a president. You know, who's the CEO of the government, you know, say good things about federal employees. I don't know if we've had anybody since John Kennedy do that.
Wow. I guess it's kind of getting into your psyche. Why? I mean, me, I don't know that I could get up every day and go to a job where every time I hear anything about myself, I'm no good and I'm greedy.
And that's why the federal employees are even more dedicated than American people know, because under those extreme circumstances and the way those things happen, they still go and function because, you know what, Rick? They're dedicated to their agencies, and they love their country, and they do their job because of that.
And thank goodness there are people on the border, and thank goodness there are people in the prisons and doing the jobs that need to be done, even if we don't appreciate it.
You know, I mean, to me, I grew up in a family where I was proud. You know, I got a degree in accounting, went to work for the government because I was proud to serve my country, not only in the military, but in civil service.
And sadly, we're in the process through our politics of destroying that love.
Oh, well, you're exactly right.
Sad day, Ron. Sad day. Ron Demicelli, president of AFGE Local 1916. I appreciate the time. Again, check out the website, explainittomegop.org. Of course, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Ron Demicelli's name. It'll take you right there. Ron, thank you so much. Love talking to you.
Yes, thank you for having me on your show, Rick.
All righty. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Bringing
insanity, and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Gotta find a way to hold it to account. People didn't find a way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you've got a Facebook page, Rick Smith or The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. I got a little comment on our Facebook page. It's one of those things that just kind of makes you laugh, where you get dumb people saying dumb things. He says, perhaps people should realize what the government is there for. Regulating private industry profits is not what the government is in the business of doing. He says, I guess if you owned a business, you would want your representative or senator telling you how much you could make. And no, that's not what we're saying. Not at all. What we're saying is I want to regulate how you do business so that everyone is on an even playing field. Like any game you're ever going to play in the history of life, all has rules. Everybody plays by the rules. I'm going to regulate how you discharge whatever waste you discharge. I'm going to regulate how you produce a product, what goes into it, because I want to make it sure it's safe for consumers. I think we all want that. I'm not going to tell you how much you can make, but the more you make, sorry, the bigger the shoulders you have, the more we're going to ask from you, because the more government services you probably use. I don't know. I have a whole bunch of friends who, you know, they're in that upper tier, not the top 1%, but in that top 20% era. They use a lot of functions of the government that I will never ever use being in the middle fifth. They use patent courts and contract courts, and they use, you know, a lot of infrastructure that we the people pay for that I'll never use. So yes, they should be required to pitch in a little bit more. And the companies that they build use the infrastructure that we the people have provided. So yeah, I'm in favor of regulating companies so that they can do business in this environment where it's equal for everybody. Just kind of an idea. A new National Journal story out about Newt Gingrich, which kind of, you know, again, makes you wonder exactly what's wrong with the Republican Party. So I just wanted to read this, just this snippet out of the National Journal story. It says, if Democrats suffered through Bush derangement syndrome during the last decade, Republican primary voters view the current president with near contempt, thanks to the lousy economy and a liberal governing agenda. Obama's unpopular health care law still is driving much of the anger. Republican media strategist Rick Wilson said he recently conducted a focus group where Republicans were asked whether, if they had a choice, whether they would kill Obamacare or have killed Osama bin Laden. And Republican media strategist Rick Wilson said they would have killed Obamacare and waited for the actuarial tables to play out for bin Laden. And I look at this and I go, that doesn't surprise me at all. Not at all. Because what you've got is you've got some pretty brain dead folks that they've been fed this line. They consume the National Journal. They consume this right-wing media that tells them, hey, that health care bill, it's going to kill us. Oh, it's horrible. Oh, we can't have it. It's no good. And they buy it. They keep hearing this story over and over and over again. And eventually they fall into it. And what I find really kind of interesting is I was reading a story today, a woman who had originally opposed Obama's health care bill. Was originally one of those people out there saying, no, we don't need it. We need to, you know, have private health. We need private stuff. Well, the 49-year-old woman, her name, Spike Ward, she's got breast cancer. Her husband's business took a major downturn. The small nonprofit that she had set up took a downturn. They gambled and said, you know what? We blew all of our savings. We took out all the equity out of our house. We emptied the 401k, paying for health insurance, paying our bills, hoping the economy would turn around. We had to make the choice between health care and mortgage. And she said, we gambled on paying the mortgage. Well, as soon as they did, boom, she's diagnosed with third stage breast cancer. And she's facing massive, massive bills into the future. And she's saying in the article, man, you know, I'm feeling guilty. I'm worn down. You know, at a time when I should be focusing on how am I going to beat this illness, I'm worried what I'm doing to my family. And she goes in and says, look, you know, no one should have to. No one should have to lose their home. And she tells a story about going to the hospital for the cash patients, which she says is a nice way of saying the uninsured. And she says, look, I'm not a deadbeat. She goes, I'm a good person. She goes, I've got two kids. I've got a house. You know, I'm not one of those people, whoever one of those people are. Because unfortunately, this woman's story is all too common. And she says, you know, as she's telling this healthcare worker, the person who's typing in all of her information, who's eventually going to take her house and force her into bankruptcy, understand that. But as she's telling this woman that, the woman says, look, I can barely afford the health insurance I get working in the healthcare field. And she said, look, you know, I've been saved. You know, eventually we were able to get some money. We were able to have the ability to get healthcare. And now because of pre-existing conditions, this federal government plan for people with pre-existing conditions, she's going to get health care. She's going to live. And now remember what Rick Santorum said yesterday. Nobody dies in America because they don't have health insurance. He said people die in America because people die, not because they're uninsured. Now, if she couldn't get this government program, think about this. When we did our food drive last year, we met a couple of people that went through this exact same thing. If she couldn't get into this federal program that's going to give her some health care, she's going to lose her house. They would file bankruptcy. They would end up being homeless. She'd get the care. She'd get cancer treatments, maybe. You're not going to get many follow-ups, and you're going to have to dig deep into your pocket. Then one of two things happens. Either once you're destitute, you qualify for Medicaid and food stamps, but you're still homeless. or you die. So she says, you know what? She says, this is my public apology. You know, I apologize for being against it. I apologize. She said, I didn't do enough of my own research to find out what promises the president has made good on. She said, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that he really has stood up for me and my family and others like us. She says, I'm getting a new bumper sticker to cover the one that says, got nope, and it's going to say Obama cares. Not for her. This works. Personally, I would have liked to have seen a Medicare for All system so we didn't have to go through all of this. But an illness can hit any one of us at any time. And we need to make sure that there's opportunity there for us. And I look at Mitt Romney. Mitt sat down with an interview with the Washington Examiner this morning. And again, pushing that idea, because, you know, if Romney came out and said, you know what, I passed Romney Care, I'm all in favor of it. It's all right. We're leaving it alone. It's a good step. It's working for the people of Massachusetts. If he came out and said, I did the right thing, I'd have more respect for him. But now he's bought into the really radical right-wing idea of we need more vouchers. Oh, we need more vouchers. So he's saying, you know what, we're gonna give vouchers to seniors to buy health care. You know, and you know what? Hey, it's not going to be an entitlement. He says, it's not, don't call this an entitlement. He said, every year pass a budget for how much the total subsidy is going to be and then set a limit of how much each person's going to receive. So as they continue to spend on everything else, they're going to dwindle down the amount of money going to Medicare. He's telling you this, and they're going to divvy it up among all the seniors who are on Medicare and all the people who are collecting, who are getting Medicare. And that's what you're going to get. So if this year you get $5,000 and my grandmother, if she had to go to the private market, probably spend $20,000 a year for health care. Sorry, Granny, you're going to have to spend $15,000 out of your pocket to cover that bill. Or if there's only $1,000, sorry, Granny, $19,000 out of your pocket. That's where they want to take us. They want to destroy any retirement security. They want that desperation class. They want prison labor. And they're telling it to you with a smile on their face. I'm just not getting why we're not seeing it. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What's on your mind? Thoughts, questions, comments, weigh in on this. I mean, do we destroy Medicare? Do we have vouchers for Medicare, vouchers for education, vouchers for health care? Let's just have vouchers for life. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union says it's not supporting a planned December 12th shutdown of West Coast ports organized by the Occupy movement. The union sent a memo to its members and leaders that said in part, quote, to be clear, the ILWU, the Coast Longshore Division, and Local 21 are not coordinating independently or in conjunction with any self-proclaimed organization or group to shut down any port or terminal, particularly as it relates to our dispute with EGT in Longview, end quote. ILWU International President Robert McElrath says that the ILWU, quote, shares the Occupy Wall Street movement's concerns about corporate abuses and the future of the middle class, but we must be clear that any actions organized by outside groups, including the proposed December 12th shutdown of various terminals on the West Coast, have not been vetted by our union's democratically led process, end quote. ILWU Local 10 President Richard Mead says its members should take guidance from this memo. He says Local 10 members have the right to speak freely and to assemble, but should make it clear that they aren't speaking officially for the ILWU when they do so. The Occupy movement says the ILWU is prevented by contracts from authorizing a port shutdown,
But Occupy says if enough protesters converge on the ports, an arbitrator will decide on the spot if it's safe for ILWU members to work. If it isn't, the workers will be sent home with pay. Thousands of protesters are in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back the Capitol action. Carl Morrow is a Wisconsin SEIU member, one of many activists who have been trying to meet with U.S. Representative Paul Ryan. They sat in at Ryan's office.
There's lots of people that are out here now. We have about, I would say, maybe 50 to 75 people, and we're going to sit here as long as it takes until, you know, he shows up, and we'll be here all week doing the same thing until somebody talks to us. We've been in Kenosha, where his office is. We've done rallies there. We've put in dozens of calls to his office, and still no response.
Edward Jude is also with SEIU in Milwaukee.
We kind of let our political leaders know the importance of them bringing jobs back into the community and trying to let them know our needs.
The current owner of the Upper Big Branch mine will pay $200 million to settle civil and criminal penalties in that mining disaster that killed 29 miners in April of 2010. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the payment from Alpha Natural Resources is a welcome beginning, but Trumka says it's far from the end of the justice that the miners and their families deserve. Trumka says the disaster was caused by corporate greed winning out over safety precautions. Trumka is calling for stiff jail sentences for those responsible for the disaster. This newscast made possible in part by the United Mine Workers of America and by the United Steel Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married. That is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going out. It's cause the gays.
Of course, it's the gays. Blame the gays for everything. Global warming, because they're, you know, they're always probably not a good idea. It's all their fault. You know, and again, I go back to anytime you talk about gay issues, I always think of the guy I used to work with, we used to drive up together, up into Massachusetts, and we'd stay overnight in a hotel, their room, because the company we worked for, that was our run. We'd go up there, and he'd stay in the hotel. I would stay in the hotel, and his girlfriend would come pick him up, take him back to their apartment, where he was with his girlfriend and her daughter, or their daughter. And then we would go back to where we lived here in Pennsylvania, and he would go home to his wife and children. And yet he was against gays because they were going to ruin the sanctity of his marriage. Not that the girlfriend and the child in another state were going to do that. No. I guess, you know, that area code thing works for him. But it was, you know, people he doesn't know somehow going to destroy all of that. And, you know, you look at Rick Perry, who, again, just nuts. But he believes that there's a war on religion. There's a war on Jesus. And he's going to be the grand defender. He's come out with a new radio, new TV ad. And you got to love this.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm a Christian, but you don't need to be in the pew every Sunday to know that there's something wrong in this country when gays can serve openly in the military, but our kids can't openly celebrate Christmas or pray in school. As president, I'll end Obama's war on religion, and I'll fight against liberal attacks on our religious heritage. Faith made America strong. It can make her strong again. I'm Rick Perry. And I approve this message.
Obama's war on religion. And I'm trying to remember. And it's like the NRA people tell me, Obama's got a war on guns. And I'm going, where? Am I missing something? I follow the news pretty closely. Did Obama kill Kennedy and I missed it? Was Obama on the grassy knoll? The guy gets blamed for everything, and I haven't seen it. Sorry, I'm not getting the references to the war on religion. But if you listen to Perry, that should scare everybody, because he's a theocrat. Understand, our First Amendment. There's no established religion. No. But those gays, they can serve openly in the military. You know, it's the same argument they used to make about minorities. Well, there are going to be colored people in the military. Can't have that. I mean, isn't it just nuts to you? I mean, at some point, don't we grow up and act like adults? Evidently not. Evidently not. But you know what, Hick? He's against gays serving in the military, but he's all in favor of breaking the law by making campaign phone calls and having campaign donors come to his office on government time while the taxpayers of Texas are paying the bill. And yes, this is a crime, evidently, according to the article that I read. In fact, they're saying, the AP story was time and time again, he picked up his office phone in the months before he announced his bid for presidency, dialing for dollars, you know, calling those wealthy friends for his big fundraisers, you know, to these state officials who owed him for their jobs, you know, that whole patronage thing. Gotta love that. See, that's the unintended consequence of getting rid of collective bargaining for state workers. Remember that. So when they come here to Pennsylvania and say, we need to get rid of collective bargaining, the unintended consequence is those jobs all become patronage jobs, like they used to be in the past. So when Corbett took office, all the Democratic, all the Rendell appointees would all be fired. You know, the guy who, you know, cleans the basket, waste baskets, person who cleans the toilets, people who, you know, who do the copy paper, all gone. And a whole set of new patronage jobs. And maybe that's where we need to go. Anyway, Mitt Romney, again, you know, you gotta love Mitt, out there saying, you know, I don't have a political career. Guy who was a governor, understand. Guy who ran for Senate, understand. I don't have a political career. He ran for office no less than four times over the last 20 years. Held office as governor, but he doesn't have a political career, evidently. Claims I'm a business guy. So, again, you know, a guy who's actually run a state government, you got to give him credit for that, trying to walk away from the idea that he understands how government works, that should scare you. And the other idiot president's candidate, Rick Santorum, the frothy one, again, you know, this guy never ceases to amaze me. And what's remarkable to me, I've been doing this program on this station now for well over a year now, about the time Santorum's been out running for president. And I've yet to have anyone call and defend the frothy one. And I got to be honest, I think people just have given up on Santorum. He's now more of a caricature, more of a, you know, the puppet in the corner that everybody kind of laughs at. But this guy is deadly serious and deadly deranged, in my opinion. He was in Lamar's, Iowa on Monday, and he was talking to people there about food stamps. Because, you know, Gingrich is out there running around saying, well, Obama's the food stamp president. I'm going to be the paycheck president. Even though the Newtster was really all in favor of extending food stamp programs throughout his career, and especially during the Bush years. But let's not talk about that. But, you know, Santorum saying, well, you know what? We need to reduce and basically, you know, cut it all back. No more federally funding. Reduce the federal funding for food stamps. And his rationale? We have fat people in the country. The fact of the matter is 48 million people are collecting food stamps right now in a country of 300 million people, he said. He said, if hunger is a problem in America, then why do we have an obesity problem among the people who we say have a hunger problem? Pretty simple. People are out of work. Wages are being slashed. And understand that on the $3 a day that you get from food stamps? I don't know how you're going to feed someone on $3 a day without eating pasta and all of the stuff that is going to make you fat. Understand the welfare diet, of which I am a subscriber, because basically that's what I grew up with. I understand it. And I think it's very arrogant of him, elitist of him, and completely out of touch. Especially when you look at the data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who said that 70% of the households that got food stamps last year earned no income whatsoever because they had no jobs. And in fact, they're saying a whopping 20% of households had no cash income at all last year. Those aren't just people collecting food stamps. So 20% of our country, 20% had no income because no job. So what you've got is you got now Santorum saying, well, let's get rid of that. Understand, food stamps have really helped soften the blow for millions of people in this country. And he literally wants to take food out of people's mouths. Think about that. So when I saw the story down in Texas, and I don't know if you saw this, but this woman, her name was Rachel Grimmer. Again, in this country, I cannot fathom. She goes down to the food stamp office, down to the public welfare office. She wants to get food stamps to feed her kids. She's got two kids, 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. They turn her down. So the 38-year-old, desperate, hopeless, sees no avenue to get out of the plight that she's in, looking into the eyes of two kids, knowing that she can't feed them, knowing that they're hungry. And I go back to when I was a kid. You know, there were many, many times when you would open the cupboards and there was literally nothing there. Nothing. Because mom didn't have money. And it was the end of the month. So here's this woman looking at these two kids, 10 and 12, with no way to feed them. And I remember talking to Tara Marks, a woman who runs a program out in Pittsburgh for folks who are struggling. She told the story, you know, she went a whole weekend without eating nothing. She consumed nothing so that her baby could eat. And she was literally passing out as she was walking down the street. In Texas, this woman, she went down to the welfare office. She filled out an application, 18 pages long, and a whole slew of documentation and identification, and you name it, 18 pages long. The woman who heads up the Texas Department of Health and Human Services says, well, you know, we were waiting on more information. Is this the Christian thing to do? So you look at the state of Texas because, you know, hey, Rick Perry's telling you, I'm not afraid to tell you, I'm a Christian. Is this the Christian thing to do? Did I tell you the outcome of this? The woman went home after being denied the food stamps, went home and looked at her children, knew she couldn't feed them, knew that they were hungry, knew that they were suffering. She took the one thing that is plentiful in Texas, a gun, shot and killed the two kids, and then killed herself. And why? Well, according to her Facebook page, can't feed my kids. She listed her occupation as may die today. Now, in Texas, the one thing that has grown to Texas-sized proportion are the number of people who are on food stamp programs. In fact, over 3.7 million people there. Almost 1.4 million people began receiving food stamps in the last 4 years alone. That means 15% of Texas is now in the food stamp program. 15% of the state. Now, he tells you, we won't be like Texas. We're going to make it America, Texas. 15% food stamp recipients. One of the highest number of minimum wage jobs. Is that what we want? I sure hope not. And you know, my heart goes out to this poor woman and anyone else desperate in that position. Because I got to tell you, I remember my mother. I don't know how she did it. I know I couldn't look into the eyes of my children and know they were hungry. Now, I would have probably taken the gun and gone somewhere else with it. I guarantee I wouldn't have. Well, I can't say that. You don't know what desperation, you don't know what condition you would be in. It's a tragedy all the way around. But it's because we have taken, as a society, this stance that, well, these people are lazy or they're deadbeats. Instead of saying, we are a Christian nation. And you know what? I don't think I would have a problem saying that this is a Christian nation if we acted like it. Quick break back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith.
Double Dippin' Joe is back in the news. Double Dip is not some soda jerk working in an ice cream shop, but that's not too far off. He's a state legislator working in Texas to jerk taxpayers around for his own financial gain. For years, Representative Joe Driver was just another obscure doolittle Texas right-winger. He kept getting elected in his solidly Republican district by ranting ceaselessly against the bugaboo of excessive government spending. But late last year, Joe flared for a brief moment into national notoriety as a blue-ribbon example of legislative hubris, stupidity, hypocrisy, cynicism on a stick. He got caught double-billing for some $60,000 in travel expenses, getting reimbursed by both his campaign fund and Texas taxpayers. In defense, the 20-year-old legislative veteran, who, by the way, serves on the Appropriations Committee, entered a plea of stupidity. "If I knew it was wrong," he said, "I wouldn't have done it that way." Imagine a common robber trying that defense. But then, robbers have ethics, whereas lawmakers just have power. Joe has now cut a deal with prosecutors. A $5,000 fine, repay what he stole, plead guilty to the felony, and get 5 years probation. That's it. No jail time. Plus, he gets to serve out the remaining year of his legislative term. Yes, Texas law allows convicted felons to stay in office. And at the end of his probation, his conviction gets wiped off the books. Wait, there's more. Driver, who piously assails government spending on other people, gets to keep his state pension. So the taxpayers he ripped off will be sending $57,000 a year to Double Dippin' Joe for the rest of his life. You see, crime does pay. If you're one of the powerful elite. This is Jim Hightower saying, and legislators like Driver wonder why common robbers are held in higher public esteem than they are.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is... Everything's raising, but the wages. Gasoline, groceries, and our hazes. Everything's raising, but the wages.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK. Also, if you've missed the program, any part of it, you want to go back and listen to it again, I said, I love that segment. I want to hear it again. RickSmithShow.com is where we've got all of our podcasts right there. And, if, of course, if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So according to some information, some data by Bloomberg News, the worldwide tax payments by non-financial U.S. companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 fell 13.2% to $222 billion in 2010 from 2007. Even though their net income rose 12.5% up to $612 billion over that period. The drop is a result of companies taking advantage of a slew of new tax breaks, as well as expansion in overseas markets, where the tax burden, of course, is a little bit lower, they claim. A recent report showed how here in the U.S., 30 corporations spent considerably more money lobbying than they actually paid in corporate taxes. And you look at the top one right at their top, General Electric. They had profits in the U.S. of about $10.5 billion. And we actually paid them almost $5 billion. So they made almost $10.5 billion, and we paid them back. They didn't pay any taxes to us. We actually paid them close to $5 billion. So their profit was, well, almost $15.5 billion, thanks to you and I. And how did they get that almost $5 billion in handouts from Uncle Sam? Well, Uncle Rick and Uncle Brett and you know, Uncle Sally and Susie and or Aunt Susie and all the people, all of us, well, they lobbied Congress. and they spent $84 million. So you stop and you think about it. $84 million lobbying, and my payday is almost $5 billion. What a bargain. PG&E Corporation, they made almost $5 billion in profit. We gave them another billion just for being here. Thanks a lot. They spent almost $79 million lobbying Verizon, Wells Fargo, American Electric Power, my favorite, Pepco Holding. All people who spent big money lobbying and getting nice returns. You know, I look at Pepco Holding, and I got to look it up. And I promise, tomorrow I will know what Pepco Holding does, at least in general. They made $882 million in profit, and we paid them another $508 million just for being here. Hey, thanks for showing up. And you know how they got that $508 million? A little lobbying. And they only spent $3.7 million. I mean, it's remarkable. And you just go down the list. Every one of them all have their own special little niche and their special little lobbying deal. And it's you and me, folks. We're the ones who get screwed in all this. It's that poor woman in Texas who 18 pages. Can you imagine? You know, I was sitting here thinking a minute ago during the break. I don't even think my mortgage. I don't even think what I filled out for my mortgage was 18 pages. Now, it was a lot of legalese and a lot of nonsense my attorney looked over. But I don't remember what I filled out. I don't remember that being 18 pages. I remember it being two or three. We got to find out how hard it is to apply for food stamps. Because 18 pages, are you kidding me? To me, you know what that says to me? That says that we're going to try and throw up as many roadblocks to people so that they can't get the benefit and that they go away and they do desperate things. Maybe end up in jail and we can use them as free labor. 18 pages. My goodness. Jeez, oh man. We can't even get the payroll tax extension passed. I mean, these people are just anything that has to do with you and me. Anything that helps the middle class, it seems the Republicans and a number of Bentley Democrats are dead set against. And, you know, I happened to see this Jim DeMint. He was out running around saying, well, you know, I don't think it's a good idea, passing this thing by raiding Social Security. You got Ron Paul out there running around saying, so the president's advocating reducing the amount of federal funding to Social Security when they're already $6 trillion short. NPR is out there saying the same thing. I mean, everybody's got it wrong. And even I had it wrong at the beginning. When it first came out, they said, we're going to reduce the amount of payroll tax coming out of the checks going into the fund. And I said, well, that seems like a dumb idea because you're reducing the amount of money going into it. And then we had David Madlin on the program from the Center for American Progress, and he said, No, they're going to pay that money from somewhere else into the Social Security Trust Fund. The money's going to go there. It's just coming from a different source. The payroll tax cut, by dropping that 2% of what we pay into Social Security from our checks is the most efficient way to get it into people's hands. It's actually very smart government. It's actually the best way, the fastest way, the quickest way to inject money into the economy is by putting it right into people's paychecks so that it's there. None of this nonsense. And again, understand where I'm coming from. Republicans are masters at politics, absolute masters. If you remember the handouts that Bush gave out, I think there was a $300 and a $500. First one was $300 per person. My wife and I got $600. And then I think it was like $500 if I remember right. But for each of them, they sent out a letter and said, you know, Congress has passed this and the president signed this. And, oh, by the way, your Bush prize is coming. Watch your mailbox. It's like Publishers Clearinghouse. Watch your mailbox. It could be there. And every day we ran to the mailbox. Oh, is my Bush prize here? And, oh, sorry, not today. And they built it up. It was in the media everywhere. Watch out. Your Bush prize is coming. They didn't pay for that. They didn't pay for those handouts. They whipped that on the credit card. So I find it extremely hypocritical that people like DeMint, we come around and say, well, you know, we not a good idea. we got to pay for it. Didn't seem to mind during the Bush years when the Bush prizes were being handed out. Didn't seem to mind not paying for it then. Didn't seem to not mind paying for two wars. Didn't seem to mind not paying for the handouts to the wealthy. Nope, didn't mind that. But the president's going, you know what? We need to keep people money in these middle-class families in their pockets. We need to keep it in their hands. They need to keep the economy going. And the most efficient way to do it is through their paychecks. It may not be politically expedient, but it's going to be economically expedient. It's going to be the most cost-effective way of getting money into the economy. Because if you remember, sending out that letter, I read somewhere it cost like $18 million to send out that letter saying, hey, your Bush prize is coming. And then another $18 to $20 million to actually send you the check. And look, I was in favor of sending through the post office. Post office needs to work. But it was bad governing. Good politics, because everybody goes, I got my Bush prize. Not many people remember what they did with their Bush prize. And, you know, I seem to think I just put it on my mortgage, which I think most people, when they got their Bush prize, that's what they did. They paid bills down with it. You know, we learned back during the 70s when Ford gave out a handout. Because if I remember right, Ford gave out $200 back in the 70s. Need to get a little jump start to the economy. And you learned back then the percentage of new consumption really didn't budge. People didn't use it for new consumption. They used it to pay for old. They used it to pay for stuff that they had already consumed. They used it to pay down debt. They used it for general expenses. But no real new consumption. It didn't add a boost to the economy. Because people had this lump sum. They had the $200 and go, well, I should put this on the mortgage. Or I should, you know, make the car payment. Or, you know, I should, you know, fix the kids' teeth or whatever. But by doing it this way, by putting it in the paycheck, you got an extra, you know, $1,000 a year. What does it break up to? Yep. $100 a week. Yep. $20 a week. $20 a week. Got that extra $20 a week in your paycheck. You're going to spend that $20 a week extra. And that is going to lead to new consumption. That is going to lead to a spiraling up because you're spending a little bit more money in the economy little by little. It's a smart way of doing things. But if you look at what the Republicans are saying, oh, we can't possibly do it. Can't possibly. What we need to do is we need to, I love this, we need to be able to bring that money back. Repatriate those funds from overseas so the job creators can have their money back. Didn't we do that once before? Yeah, we did. But, you know, they didn't do it right the last time. We're going to try again because this time, you know, they learned their lesson. You know the lesson they learned? They learned they can repatriate all that money, pay less tax on it. They could buy back their shares of stock, thus making themselves richer by cashing in on the shares of stocks because the amount of shares will be lower and you can raise the stock price up and they can give themselves big bonuses. And they can lay off American workers because it's exactly what they did the last time they did it. So I am dead set 110% against them repatriating that money at a lower tax rate. You want to bring that cash back to the U.S.? You're paying it. And as the government, we should say no more of that holding money overseas. We're changing how the IRS looks at it. And you're going to pay it as it goes. We're not going to allow it to stockpile because there's too much of that. Oh, well, you know, if we were just allowed to bring this back, we could create jobs. Because the simplistic, the simple-minded would go, oh, so you think of create jobs with that. Doesn't happen. Friends, jobs are created when there is demand. When working people have money, they consume. If you have no money, you do not consume. You steal, and then you go to jail. And now you're the product, and they're benefiting off of you. And, hey, why not? Little free labor out of you. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
to the Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13. For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. But Wall Street politicians are coming after workers and their unions like never before. AFSCME's Main Street movement is pulling together. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And I got to tell you, you know, the more you look at this Occupy movement, the more they're making headway. You look at New York; they were hell bent against raising taxes on the rich of the rich, and well, it looks like Cuomo, Democrat, caved, and in a good way this time. They're going to raise some taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. Also in the deal, from what I've gathered to this point, going to lower some of the tax rates on many of the middle class residents. Again, devil's in the details, but looks to me like a good thing at this point. Anyway, to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
Finally, a Democrat caves in a good way.
Yeah, well, it depends what you mean by that.
Well, they raise taxes on the very wealthy while cutting taxes on some of the middle-class folks, if that's the way it actually pans out.
If that's the way it pans out, but the president, once again, I mean, the president's doing a lot of warnings at the moment. He warned again today at a brief news conference after a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. The president said he would block any efforts by Congress to attach the payroll tax cut provision to the Keystone Pipeline project.
Right.
He said, any effort to try to tie Keystone to the payroll tax cut, I will reject. He said the reason is because the payroll tax cut is something House Republicans and Senate Republicans should want to do regardless of any other issues.
Absolutely.
He went on, my warning is not just related to Keystone. Efforts to tie a bunch of other issues to something they should do anyway will be rejected by me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's talk of them trying to tie in the repatriation, which, again, another screw job to workers in this country. A whole bunch of things, you know, whatever the Republicans, you gotta love it. We don't like earmarks. We don't like dirty backdoor, smoky filled room politics. But what do? They do crap like this.
Well, I mean, you know, you've got to try and add some stuff. It's called sweeteners.
A little sweetener.
There are no more earmarks, and there are only so many committee slots that you can offer the people to get them to vote your way. So you put sweeteners into a bill, and that's what they're trying to do, to try and get some of these Tea Partiers to come along. But some of them are such true believers, they're not willing to do it anyway. They simply don't want a payroll tax cut.
You know, like the song my kids sing from that stupid movie that I never remember the name. A little sugar makes the medicine go down.
That's Mary Poppins.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it is. The kids love that movie. But it's true. You need that little sweetener, I guess. If they're so ideologically opposed to helping middle-class families and so ideologically opposed to helping people who are unemployed, which they are. So there you go. Anyway, big news out of the HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services.
Well, this was fascinating because the FDA had decided that Plan B, which is the morning after pill, could be used safely by girls and women of all ages, and that no longer would it be restricted, basically, to being able to be bought over-the-counter by girls of 17 and over. Everybody else would have to have a prescription, and that it was going to go on the shelves with your contraceptive sponges and your condoms. And so that was all ready to happen. And then today, in a big surprise, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius overrode her and rejected this request and said, no, this is not going to happen. It will not be available to anyone at any age without a restriction.
And that would be, you got to have a prescription.
Exactly, exactly. So if you're under 17, you will still have to get a restriction, prescription. Excuse me, my prescription's confused here. Now,
what if you're over 18? I mean, what if you're over 18? Is it something that's saleable over the counter? Or
yes.
Is this something you still
yes.
need a prescription
yes.
for?
No, if you're 17 plus, you can get it over the counter.
Okay, so this is, I think I'm okay with that.
Now, interestingly, they had done some research on this because President Bush had said, well, we don't think it's safe for young girls because they won't be able to do it, and we don't think it's safe. And so they did research. They did two studies, one with girls 12 to 17 and one with girls 11 to 16, to see if they could use the product properly and safely. And they both could in the study, 12 to 17, between 72% and 96% of them understood the proposed package label well enough to use the drug safely and effectively on their own. Of course, that doesn't mean that philosophically people agree with the idea of them going in and actually buying it on their own.
Yeah, I got to be honest. You know, I got a daughter who's 9, and those ages are only really very close in front of me. And the thought of wow, that scares me to death.
I understand.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't really thought of, and I'm going to have to rethink this because you know the reality is I want women to have access. I just don't know that you know I want my 11 or 12 year old. Wow, that's a tough one.
It's a very tough one. It's it really is very, very tough. And of course, this is a big victory for those who oppose this on any grounds. They say that this decision would expose girls and women to potential risks from taking high doses of a potent hormone, interfere with girls' parents' ability to monitor their children. Of course, make it easier for men to prey on vulnerable minors, which, of course, they can do in many other ways.
And this is just another one of those. I told my wife, I said, when she gets a little older and starts dating, just get me the cyanide capsule. I can wear it around my neck, and I can just bite on that. Just end it right there.
That's what you do.
At least that's what I think I'm going to end up having. I've got two daughters, which I'm not.
Looking, oh well, you're done.
I am. I am not looking forward to the teen years. Scary.
There's
stuff.
Nothing to look forward to. I've been a teenager. I didn't speak to my mother for nearly 2 years.
Oh. Well, my daughter doesn't talk to my wife now.
Oh well, she's starting early.
And that seems to be the thing. Boy, they seem to be starting earlier and earlier with the stomping of the foot and the making of the demand. All in all, I can't say anything. My wife's doing a great job with the kids. Last night we talked with one of the local presidents of the Postal Workers Union here. He was from Lancaster, and he's telling us about this massive downsizing and the closing of all these distribution centers. And really, you know, when you hear them say what the Postal Service is going to do, it's the end of it. Just pack up the bags. Game over.
Yeah, the head of the union representing letter carriers says that the Postmaster General is pushing the Postal Service into, quote, a death spiral. He's also questioning why the White House is supporting the reduction to 5 days a week mail delivery, saying, we believe, the majority of Congress believes, the American people believe, and thousands of businesses believe that six-day delivery is vital to the future of the Postal Service. And I think, you know, many people do believe that, but many other people are actually saying, no, I'm okay with 5 days a week. I just don't want my post office to close.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of this, though, I mean, this is the worst time to be doing this, especially when the reality is Congress could make the change. If we're going to treat the post office like any other business in this country, which people seem to want to think it is. If we're going to treat them like everybody else, let's actually treat them like everybody else. Take away that pension mandate. I mean, do you know they've got to pay a pension 75 years in advance? So they're paying a pension on a worker that isn't even born yet.
No, it's crazy. Oh, if we're going to treat them like any other business, then give them a bailout.
Well, or that, yes. Or let them set their rates wherever they want, wherever the market, you know, that market thing they keep talking about? Because 44 cents,
yeah.
44 cents is really low. You go up to Canada, I think it's almost a buck to send a letter.
Oh, it's considerable. It's double or triple to send a letter in England. I think what to me has caused the demise of the Postal Service, and I use the post office a lot. I pay my bills by mail. I like to. If I can't be assured pretty much that a letter is going to get there tomorrow, I am not comfortable with that.
That's the end of it.
And they're getting rid of that.
Yeah, and that's the end of it. I mean, once you start saying we're going to start lagging on, in this day and age, this I want it done now. I want it as fast as possible. I want it in a neat little package out a little window. That's death.
This was the mistake. I think people would have tolerated five-day delivery. I really do. I think they would have tolerated that. They would have said, okay, yeah, it comes Monday to Friday. Yeah, we don't get it Saturday, Sunday. That's cool. It's the weekend. It's cool. But to hear that it takes 2 days,
yep.
Really, my magazine's not going to arrive on time?
What, my Netflix isn't going to get here?
People won't tolerate that.
My Netflix? I'm going to have to wait for my Netflix? Yeah, I mean, and think about Netflix. Think about the business model there. I mean, they've got problems now, too.
This is huge for Netflix. This is huge for Netflix.
Yep. And, you know, again, I think this is just the dumbest possible thing. And lastly, today is Pearl Harbor Day. Charlie Rangel back on the path?
Yes. Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois, was lauding the actions of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, working to protect Afghans from terrorist elements within that country. And he was listening to him talking about that, and Rangel was speaking on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Said he was moved by Kinzinger's remarks, said the burden the U.S. military bears must be borne by all, and saying it is abundantly clear that everybody does not assume the same sacrifices, whether we're talking about taxes or loss of life. I submit we have to have a draft, not a plea for those people who, for economic reasons, have to protect themselves.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of a draft. I think everyone should have some type of service, be it military, be it public service, be it something, at least a year, maybe two. Because I guess my idea being is, if all of our tails were on the line, do you think we'd be in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yes.
I know we wouldn't be in Iraq.
I think it would be much more difficult for us to be in Iraq with the draft.
Yep.
And I think many, many things would change for the draft. I mean, of course, a lot of people managed to get out of it. People like Newt Gingrich would get out of it. But then they would be on the record with the reasons why they got out of it.
Yep. I'm a big fan of national service. I think it's the right thing to do. And I think what it does is, you know, the Republicans love to say about taxpayers, they need to have some skin in the game. This would put people skin in the game. It's easy to send someone else's kids off to fight, bleed, and die. It's a whole nother ballgame sending your own or yourself.
Indeed.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Great talking to you.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Can't tell it if you want to.
back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the website's the best place to go to get our podcast, which is there. If you can, I missed a segment, or I really liked that one, go listen to it again on the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app. So everyone by now, I think, knows the Arizona Sheriff, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You know, he's in the news quite often, you know, pretty much being a doofus. But this latest story kind of grabbed my attention to go, well, whatever happened to Sheriff Joe being, you know, the rough and tough guy, you know, make sure he, you know, sheriff for life. They're saying that he failed to investigate over 400 sex crimes, including the molestation of undocumented children. You go, really? Sheriff Joe, what happened to, we need to clamp down on the law? They're saying at least 32 reported child molestations went uninvestigated, with victims as young as 2 years old. I guess, and I guess this is just kind of how he, maybe he saw it. Yeah, they're here, they're illegals. They're not real people. Which is just sick. Absolutely just sick. Well, I don't know if you saw the big news. The big news is, Jerry Sandusky back in jail. He was arrested today after two new charges against him were levied. In fact, one of the people who came forward said that he was in the basement of the Sandusky home screaming in vain. These latest two are the ninth and tenth victims to come forward and to have charges filed against Sandusky. They claim that, you know, hey, you know, he befriended them, and then before you know it, well, doing what they were doing. And for me, you know, it's one thing. I mean, you know, I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to say it without sounding kind of strange. But you know, it's one thing for him to have molested the children. It's something completely different to have that power position, that position of I'm helping you, and this is helping you. I mean that psychological. I mean both of them screw these kids up. But that holding that power position, that pedestal position that people gave him. That's something else. Now he couldn't immediately come up with the $250,000 cash bail, so there he was, locked up. And you know, there's part of me says, you know, at this point, for his own safety, maybe you know, locking him up not such a bad idea. You know, and some of the stories that I heard on this, just disgusting and sad. You know, the sad part about this is that I have to believe people knew. I have to believe that those around him knew. And, you know, if you buy what Jake was talking about last night, that, you know, Paterno wanted him out and the school said no, and if you buy that, they absolutely knew. Sad, sad stuff. And, you know, when you see this stuff coming out, I mean, you look here at Penn State going on there. Syracuse had their problems. Boston, someone that was up on that pedestal in the same position. And, you know, you look at this and you go, is there anybody you can trust? So I look at the aftermath of Penn State, what's going on there. Their new president, Rodney Erickson, he was interviewed this week, talking about, well, you know, we need to transform the university. We need to transform the image, the public face from one of a football factory to one of a world-class research institution. And when I read that, I'm going, either you're full of it or you're insane. Because you know, people are not going, they want a football factory, man. Once this dies down and Sandusky's convicted, they want to go back to winning. The alumni are not going to be kicking money back to the university unless you're winning. But I find it interesting that that Erickson has said that the university is going to establish this national center for the protection of children. They're going to do research. They're going to provide treatment. And there's part of me that says they're probably doing it so that they don't. I mean, I guess there's a whole ready-made bunch of folks to help a whole bunch of clients. Maybe they'll profit off of it. But they're saying that they're going to bring in, experts from the university's 24 campuses. It'll be housed at the Hershey Medical Center's Children's Hospital. It will be funded by the Big Ten. They're going to get $2 million. And I'm going, really, $2 million? That's what you could scrape up? Interesting. Yeah, I mean, this story is just getting weirder and weirder by the day. The other day, there was somebody from the Harrisburg area who claimed that, Sandusky gave him whiskey and, trying to, do a little something-something there, touching him and doing some other inappropriate things. And I go back to the guy that was the athletic director of my high school. I still remember that guy. And everybody knew. I mean, that's my problem in all of this, is that everybody truly knew. And yet the powers to be did nothing. If there's one allegation, you get one allegation, it's devastating. But when you have numerous people saying, hey, there's something going on here, there's a problem. And I hope this guy gets what's coming to him. I hope he gets what he deserves. Just really, really, really sad. Anyway, on the immigration front, Michelle Bachmann, I love Michelle Bachmann. I so cannot wait to go to New Hampshire. And we're going to bring you coverage from New Hampshire. I guess it's January 10th is the New Hampshire primary. We're going to be up there Monday night and Tuesday night as the results come in up there in New Hampshire. And we're hoping a picture with Michelle Bachmann, the whole Rick Smith Show staff right there, hugging Michelle Bachmann, a big group hug. And anybody who knows me knows I am not someone who hugs. I'm not a hugger. Now, Brett, my producer here, the guy who keeps everything sounding great and the knobs moving, he, big hugger. Me, not so much. But Michelle Bachmann, I will actually attempt. She's going to shoot me down, but I'll try. Anyway, she has this great idea. And you gotta love it, gotta give her credit. She's insane, and I do kinda give her credit for being insane. She has a grand, immigration policy. She wants to get a big bus, pick everybody up, kick them out. So she was on with Bill O'Reilly. And when O'Reilly sounds rational, you know you have a problem. You know someone is sitting there, someone who's sitting across from it is crazy. So Bachmann was on with O'Reilly, and well, here's the clip of it, which listen.
Men that are here now are going to be an enormous problem to deal with, because there are a lot of people here, been here for a lot of years, and if you're going to start dragging them out of here, it's going to be very, very difficult to do that.
But remember, they broke the law to get in here.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying on a human basis, I don't think theory is one thing. Dragging people out, putting them on a bus with their children's crying.
It can be done. That's the thing. It can be done.
It can be done, but at what cost?
But
And when O'Reilly sounds reasonable, I have to take notice. She's saying, look, we can drag these people out with their kids screaming and carrying out. We drag these people out and put them on the bus. And he's right. At what cost? At what cost to our society? At what cost to our treasury? And at what cost to our civilization? Understand, if you start doing this, you pursue this path, you're going to drive those people deeper underground. That means they're going to be more exploitable. That means they're going to be more... you're now backing them into a corner. They're going to be desperate. Now you're putting law enforcement in harm's way. And she has no way of paying for it. She has no idea how she's going to go about it, but she's out there spewing it. She's spewing right out. Doesn't care about the cost. I love her claim. And again, these numbers just... Why nobody fact checks? Why nobody? She claimed that 50% of Mexico's population has moved north of the border. And nobody really called her on it. Half of Mexico is here in the U.S. Did you know that? Half of the country is right here. And she wants to be president. Now, look, you know, I've said from the beginning, the way you deal with immigration is pretty simple. It's the same way you deal with prostitution. You go after the Johns. You leave the prostitutes alone. They're the victims in this just as much as anybody. You go after the Johns. You go after the employers. You go after the farmers in Alabama who, the state ran out all of our workers. Give us some prisoners. You go after those people. Start paying decent wages. That's the reality in all this. But according to Michelle, no, can't do it. Sorry, we're going to put people on buses. Going to rip them out of their homes in the middle of the night. Wow. I don't want to live in Michelle Bachmann's world. That's a scary, scary place. And the reality is I don't know that I want to live in Newt Gingrich's world either. Because he claims he's going to ask John Bolton to be his Secretary of State. Can you imagine the guy who said we could blow the top 10 floors off of the UN and nobody would notice? Being the top diplomat for the country? Really? Is that a good idea, you think? We're gonna show our strength. No, we're gonna show our arrogance. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna tick people off. And then the attacks begin. That's what frightens me. Anyway. Frustrating stuff. Anyway, if you want to contact me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com is the best place to go. We do archive all of our programs. Been there, I think there's probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 years of programs on there. Also, if you've got a smartphone, the Stitcher app, take the program on the go. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO.
It's scary that a guy could be in the well of the state house, or well of the, the state legislature in Tennessee and say, we need to adopt the European model. Then this is a lifelong Republican.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, according to the little clock at the lower right hand of my screen, you're going to need to say some nice things about people that mean the world to you, so I'm getting out of the way.
All right. See you, David.
Later.
Bye now.
All right.
It's like watching a country dissolve in a bottle of Coca-Cola.